when these kind of things happened, and you never, never saw, no matter how much you disagreed with the person sitting in the Oval Office, the commander in chief, you never did this kind of sniping. Never. It used to be considered unpatriotic. Now, it seems just the opposite. And I've got to wonder. You know, you got to go and you got to wonder how much of this is the black guy in the White House more than it's a Democrat-Republican thing. I just got to throw that out there. You got to at some point wonder that. Because, you know, when I was a kid growing up, never heard this. Never. You had disagreements. But you never went there. Also tonight, going to talk about more on the opt-out movement as the testing here in Pennsylvania, at least for my kids, ramps up next week. What should parents be doing? I've had a number of conversations with friends who have kids same age as my daughter, and they like me, and there's an undercurrent here of parents going, don't like it, don't like the testing at all, don't see the benefit of it, but still don't want to pull that trigger and opt out because, oh, they'll take money from the school. We'll find out more about that later on in the program. Also, what's going on in West Virginia with the Freedom Water. You got to love Freedom Water. I'm going to find out from a guy who has written a book on the war on West Virginia. Also, I guess we're selling off the rest of the Internet, more privatization. We'll also find out what happens if we privatize the Internet and go, here, free world, take it. What can we expect? Also going to take your thoughts, your questions, comments, whatever's on your mind, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You can also email me, Rick, at RickSmithShow.com, Twitter, at Rick Smith Show, Facebook, Facebook.com/The Rick Smith Show. So, today, the big press conference in Harrisburg. You know the basics of it. Look, we wanted to raise the minimum wage. There are a number of people. Patty Kim spoke. Representative Mark Cohen spoke. Senator Tina Tartaglia-Lone spoke. All of these people spoke about how, and eloquently, I may add, very eloquent, had a couple of low-wage workers who stood up and said, you know what, I would like to get a raise. I would like to be able to support my family. I would like to be able to not have to ask for help. All of the things that we've talked about raising the minimum wage, they focused on today at the press conference. And I keep coming back to the very first question that the reporters asked. And, of course, I didn't get to ask it. Someone else did. They chose someone else. Which is, you've got a governor who has stated openly and publicly that there's just no way. the cows could come home. The great depths of the southern plain well below our feet where the where hell is supposed to be could freeze, and still there would be no raise in the minimum wage. So how do you get past that? And I got to be surprised that, you know, I thought the right answer, and this is why I don't stand up on the stage, this is why you get rid of that guy. This is the reason working people, of which you are the majority in this state, you get rid of the guy who's saying no. You get rid of the guy who's standing between you and being able to put food on the table. Seems logical to me. Didn't really come up. Now, I guess, you know, part of it is, quite possibly, corporate America has done a marvelous, amazing, masterful job of getting you to identify with them. That somehow that McDonald's, that global empire, is somehow your neighborhood McDonald's, and the other purveyors of poverty wage, they do the same thing. We're your local, we're your friends and neighbors. We live right next door. I'm going, really? I don't know the Waltons living in my neighborhood. I didn't know Ray Kroc moved in to our little neck of the woods. I didn't see that. Didn't see the caravan of moving trucks pulling into my neighborhood. I have seen, however, a number of for sale signs of people who are underwater on their mortgage trying to get out. Haven't seen the billionaires moving in. And when you look at a company like McDonald's, and I'm going to just pick on McDonald's for a minute, not because they're special, they're just the one. They're the one everyone follows. The industry follows. Same thing as with Walmart. They're the one the industry follows. They set the standard. So these are the standard bearers. So if they chose to say, we're going to raise the standard, you would have to think that everyone might come along. Or maybe we just had government policy that said, you know what, we're going to set the floor, that everyone, even you, with all of your lobby money and all of your political clout, even you have to follow it. If you set that floor to where nobody falls below it, then we alleviate some of these problems. And then from there, you know, hopefully we then move forward. But this idea that you can have a floor way down in the basement kind of makes me go that what you're going to see is more low-road employment. Because if the bottom is so low, where do you think the middle is going to be? And this is, again, as I've said a number of times, purely from an economic standpoint, once you raise up the bottom, the middle goes up, the upper middle goes up a little bit, and as you go higher and higher, of course, that jump dissipates. And look, do we really need the billionaires to make any more? I mean, honestly, I'm in favor of people being comfortable and well-off and well-to-do and let them be rich as they want to be, but you know, the reality is when you're doing it at the expense of the people below you, I have a problem with that. And what we're seeing, especially in these low-wage industries, is a systematic, methodical stealing of wages. A systematic, really just dismantling of what the middle class used to stand for, which is hard work, dedication, loyalty. But now you look at it and you kind of go, wait a second. Something going a little awry here. And you look at McDonald's alone. Taxpayers give them about $1.2 billion each and every single year, according to the National Employment Law Center. $1.2 billion. We could have spent that on other things, trust me. We've got a lot of roads and bridges. We've got internet that needs to be fixed. We've got a lot of things we should be doing, but we're not. We're handing it off to the fast food industry, to the big box retail industry. You name it, we're handing corporate America huge, huge windfalls. And at whose expense? Ours, our kids, their future, the future of our infrastructure, the future of our national defense for all of my Warhawk friends. Because that money's got to come from somewhere. And you look at the fast food industry, seven of the big publicly traded fast food places. Last year, almost $7.5 billion in pure profit. That's above and beyond the nearly $53 million they handed out to their head guys, and the $7.7 billion that they handed out in dividends to shareholders, and the stock that they bought back. So you're looking at, you know, over $15 billion that an excess operating expense, if you will, what we used to call profit, not going to the people who created the profit, the workers, but being distributed at the very top. And I got a problem with that, which is why, again, I go back to the whole idea of this is why you need to unionize. It's because you sit down at the bargaining table and you go, hey, you know what? Open the books. That's all I want to see. Don't tell me about anything. Show me the books. And we will talk about what's in the books. If you're losing money, obviously you're going to come back and say, hey, we need to cut back. But when times are wildly well, never better, when corporate America is lining their pockets while, well, my neighbors are buying store brand mac and cheese, there's a problem. And, you know, we've seen it for the last several months. Fast food workers are saying, hey, you know what? We're tired of toiling in poverty. We're tired of living in the homeless shelter, coming and serving you your burgers and fries. And, hey, think about this, folks. Next time you go into the drive-thru, that person handing you the thing through the window, or the person who probably cooked it, quite possibly could be living in a homeless shelter. Because we have seen that time and time and time again. But I know. But, Rick, don't you know those folks? Those are second jobs. It's teenagers getting their first job so they can buy a new bicycle. It's grandma who needs bingo money. Didn't you know that? Ridiculous. And the studies bear it. It is ridiculous. Now, the reality in all of this is people are working harder and harder for less and less. And we're seeing the productivity gains, of which have been going up and up and up and up every single year, which means you're working harder. That's what that means. You're working harder, but you're sharing less of it. And I like to throw out what the Wall Street Journal reported, that had wages kept up with productivity, had the minimum wage kept just up with productivity, as much work, you know, the meritocracy we love to hear about. Because, you know, the right pushes this on us a lot. Well, you know, if they were harder workers and if they brought more to the table, they could make more. It's a meritocracy, Rick, don't you know? Again, I go back to more than $15 billion in profit for the fast food industry. Had the minimum wage just kept up with productivity gains, it would be almost $21.72 an hour. And had it kept up with the growth of the top 1% who are now reaping all the benefits, it would be $22.62 an hour. That's 212% higher than the current wage floor. And you go, but Rick, there's no way they can afford that. $15 billion in pure profit that didn't go to the people who worked it. Now understand, these workers, they're the ones who produced it. They're the ones who were there busting their behinds. They were the ones sweating over the grill. They were the ones smiling to the customers and putting out the product, but they're not the ones sharing the fruits of their labor. And understand, profits have soared. So the CEO, he got himself a big fat raise. You've got the CEO of McDonald's who makes almost $14 million each and every year, while the average fast food worker makes a little over $8 million. Something seriously wrong. And when you have a situation where the fast food workers are working 40 hours a week and twice as likely as any other worker to ask for public assistance, I think you got a problem. So as I look at this, a raise for people who work for a living is a good anti-poverty program, considering we got more than 7 million kids in this country who fall below the poverty line, whose parents work in minimum wage jobs. Immediately, we should be turning that around. And there are a number of bills that they were talking about today at the big press conference, ones that would raise it up to 10-10 over the next 3 years. There was one, I guess it was 12 over the next 3 years. All in the same ballpark, and fortunately, all of them, every one of them, indexed to inflation, which I think is vitally important, so we don't have these erosions every 2, 3, 5, 10 years, depending on how long it takes to raise it again, because it's not going to be raised this year. We know this. This is a build for next year, whoever the new governor is going to be, because Corbett isn't going to be the guy to do it, which, again, is why he has to go. But it will be raised. It's just going to take an awful lot of work. And I hope that as the days, weeks, and months come along, and we're going to be talking about this issue for quite some time, we're going to talk to the workers, you know, those lazy people who aren't worth more than minimum wage. We're going to talk to some of those people to see what their jobs are like, what their lives are like, and expose folks who may never know. I know people who don't know anyone who works for minimum wage. So hopefully it will be an eye-opening experience. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
13,000 patient healthcare workers at the University of California could be on strike March 24th. The workers took a strike vote, and 97% of them approved a five-day strike to start March 24th. AFSCME Local 3299 says the strike is an unfair labor practices strike triggered by UC's imposing contract terms that includes healthcare benefit cuts. The union also takes exception to an emergency layoff clause in UC's contract proposal. AFSCME calls that a poison pill. The workers want to reach a fair negotiated contract settlement with UC, and AFSCME is calling...
Right-of-ways of the American railroads, you are losing hands-on inspections of moving trains, of track. Mechanical and track inspections are absolutely essential to the interest of public safety. We want to guard against needless alarmism. However, we want to encourage that all parties move with urgency to protect public safety.
New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio is trying to figure out how to make good on back pay for the city's teachers union without creating financial problems for the city. The teachers have been working without a contract for 4.5 years. The union is seeking a new labor contract and will want to make up the back pay. The city is having trouble coming up with the $3.4 billion that it will cost for 2 of the years teachers have been working without a contract. Mayor de Blasio is proposing a 9-year contract deal to stretch the back wage payments over a longer time period. A deal with teachers is just part of the picture. Mayor de Blasio is also working on a comprehensive approach to negotiating deals with all of New York City's labor unions who were unable to reach agreements with former Mayor Michael Bloomberg.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
The Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from the Bank of Labor, a division of Brotherhood Bank and Trust, member FDIC, equal opportunity lender. Union-owned, union-represented Bank of Labor offers a business Visa card with no annual fee and points earned with every purchase, along with rental vehicle and travel accident insurance. Online at bankoflabor.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
If you take a what I would call a reasonable scientific approach to that, we believe those consequences are manageable. They do require us to begin to exert or spend more policy effort on adaptation. And as human beings, as a species, that's why we're all still here. We have spent our entire existence adapting. Okay, so we will adapt to this.
Oh, yeah, we'll adapt, won't we, Rex? Rex Tillerson, the CEO of ExxonMobil. Yeah, we'll adapt, you know, when the climate goes south and everything gets crazier and we get, you know, go from 3 feet of snow to 60 degrees the next day. Yeah, we'll adapt. We'll figure it out. I still like the guy who's the head of the company who is the biggest fracker in the country telling me that we'll adapt, but not going to allow a facility that aids in the fracking process near his $5 million vacation home. I find that very interesting. Don't you? I mean, on some level. Here's another one that grabs my attention. Remember the Freedom Industries guy, the CEO there, Gary Southern, a guy who makes about $230,000 a year, not a huge salary, but according to recent reports, Mr. Southern, he wants to be paid for disaster. He wants to be paid for all the hours he worked in cleaning up his mess, the 10,000 gallons of the mystery chemical that gave us that wonderful freedom water that when you drink it, you vomit uncontrollably. And what says freedom more than uncontrollable vomit? Anyway, here to talk to us a little bit about what's going on in West Virginia, and more importantly, his book, War West Virginia, a novel of the quest for justice in the Appalachian coal fields. I've got Michael Abraham. Michael, thanks for taking time for us.
It's nice to be here. Thanks.
So I looked at the CEO guy going, hey, I want to be paid. I caused the disaster, but still, I want to be paid for it.
Reminds us of the guy during the BP spill who was complaining about how many overtime hours he was working while everybody's lives were being disrupted on the Gulf Coast.
Yeah, I mean, you know, while you're vomiting because of the freedom water, he wants to get paid. Interesting. So, I mean, but I look at this, and to me, it's not surprising. We've I guess, almost become accustomed to disasters in places where we have extraction going on, West Virginia, Tennessee, here in Pennsylvania. You know, it's almost become commonplace.
Well, and, you know, it's the story of extractive industries. And you look at the places you mentioned here in the Central Appalachians. You look anywhere around the world, you look at silver mining in the Andes, you look at gold and diamond mining in Africa, virtually anywhere you go, you will see an impoverished people who work the resource, and you'll see phenomenal wealth being channeled to the owners of the resource who, in most cases, don't live there and don't have to deal with the aftermath. You know, the book that I wrote, War, West Virginia, it's my third novel. I name all my novels after real places. And it turns out there really is a city, a very small city in West Virginia called Ward. It's the southernmost city in the state. And I learned about it when I was writing my first book, which is a nonfiction look at this sort of unusual sibling relationship between Virginia and West Virginia. It's called The Spine of the Virginias. And I went to McDowell County, where Ward is located, and what I found was by far the poorest county in West Virginia, the third poorest state in the nation. And I'm asking myself, you know, we talk so much about, or we hear so much talk about the blessing of coal and this, you know, huge resource that we have here. And, you know, I was talking to someone who lives there, and they said, if it's such a blessing, why are the places that we mine the most of it the poorest in the country? McDowell County is by far the poorest county in the state. But it's given the state and the country and the world at this point, because we're exporting a lot of coal, it's the most productive east of the Mississippi, and yet it's the poorest county in the state. Where are these riches going? And, you know, what is it about this blessing? You know, it's more of a curse, I think, for the people who live there.
Yeah. Because I've often said, you know, you look at places like West Virginia, where there's just untold amounts of wealth being taken out from under their feet. Why is it that not every person has health care or a living wage or the ability to put food on the table? And I've got friends who live kind of in that area who, you know, they live in extreme poverty and they struggle from day to day to get by. And you go, but you've got all of this wealth being stripped from your ground. How is it possible that you're not sharing in this? And the same can be said for parts of Pennsylvania. Where the coal industry basically raped the land and looted and left.
Exactly. Like I said, it's the same story. I had an opportunity to go to Bolivia a couple of years ago, and I went to a city called Potosi, which is high in the Bolivian Andes. And the mountain behind it is called Cerro Rico. It's a pyramidal-shaped mountain that's been in constant mining extraction for 500 years. Potosi is now one of the poorest places in the world. The rivers are contaminated. Heavy metals, mercury poisoning, the whole bit. You know, anywhere in the world that you see extractive industries. But I've been particularly interested in the plight of West Virginia, our sister state. I live just across the border in Virginia. But I've always been interested in West Virginia and how this whole situation has played out over there. Obviously, there's a lot of sentimentality. People who do coal mining are very proud of it in some cases.
Sure, it's honest work.
Yeah, it's honest work. They work hard. They go underground. It's dangerous. And I had a black man in the area told me that he was in the military. And he said there are awful racial problems in the military. But when you go underground, everybody, you go in as black people and white people. But when you come out, everybody's black.
Right.
And he said, you know, you owe your life to the guy next to you and him to yours. And there's a camaraderie that he's just never experienced anywhere else. So there's some issues that make people proud of what they do. But at the same time, why should anybody have to die young just because they've chosen a particular occupation? There was a recent article in one of the major newspapers, national newspapers, about the disparity in life expectancy between McDowell County, West Virginia, and I think Fairfax County, Virginia. And the difference in the average life expectancy of a male is something like 15 years. And these places are, you know, a six-hour drive apart. Why should it be that different? Why are we sacrificing these people? Why can they not have the benefits of the same types of, call them amenities, birthrights, I think, better than amenities, clean air, clean water, you know, good schools. You know, why are we subjecting these people to these unending horrors of polluted water, you know, of black lung disease, lack of health care? You know, why are we doing this to our fellow man?
Because
the people who own the resource can do that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, what's interesting is, you know, we had done a labor history tour over last summer across the country, and we stopped in Blair, West Virginia, Blair Mountain, to talk about the Battle of Blair Mountain. And we were met by by a group of people, friends of coal. They came and they set up a It was pretty amazing how we pull in within 5 minutes. They're setting up, supposedly cleaning up trash on a road where there's no trash.
Yeah.
But they come with their sidearms and, you know, all of this stuff to kind of intimidate us to go away. But I remember walking up to them and talking to them, and the reality is these folks have been led to believe from birth that it's all they've got. There's
right.
nothing else. The only choice you have is coal. And those outsiders, all of those other people want to take this from you. And I was trying to convey the thought that you're being thrown false choices. You're probably going to have, you know, all kinds of health problems from doing it. You're probably going to die younger. And oh, by the way, thanks to Patriot Coal, they're stealing your pensions.
Well, and beyond that, when you're done with this extraction, then what have you got?
Yeah.
Okay, at some point this is going to play out. You know, I look at this situation right now, the water situation in Charleston, where the water supply has been poisoned for 300,000 people. And I think the worst job you could have in the whole East Coast of the United States right now is being in the economic development officer for Charleston, West Virginia.
Yeah.
Because nobody's going to come.
No freedom water.
Okay. No businesses are going to relocate in Charleston, West Virginia, because they're not going to subject their employees to poison drinking water, or even the suspicion of it. And, you know, so environmental protection is good for business. Regulation is essential for maintaining a healthy environment, which is essential for maintaining a healthy economy.
I'm right there
okay?
with you.
The people who come into town, you know, the bleeding heart liberals who come into town and say, you know, you got a problem here, they're not trying to ruin these people's lives or their lifestyle. They're trying to help these people prepare for a future beyond coal. And you know, the whole concept of a friend of coal. I mean, what does this mean? It sort of strikes me as the idea of a war on terror. You know, terror is a tactic. It's not an enemy.
Right.
Coal is a rock. You know, we don't need rocks for friends. What we need are people for friends. Okay? We're friends of people. We're friends of the coal miners. We're friends of the environment that protects those miners and lets them have a life after mining.
Let me ask you, let me stop you there for a second, because, you know, what it's, I can hear my UMWA friends saying, well, you're against coal, and you're against the coal miners and the workers, and can you be against coal and still be in favor of the workers and support them?
Well, I mean, look at it this way. When you talk about mountaintop removal mining, mountaintop removal mining is destroying the environment of southern West Virginia, and the downside from the UMW standpoint and from the worker standpoint is that it requires a lot less workers.
Yeah.
Okay, the positive side for those workers is it's probably safer than going underground. But where I'm, you know, my work in McDowell County, West Virginia, McDowell County had 98,000 residents in 1950. Today it has 22,000. It's probably the largest non-disaster-related diaspora the country's ever seen because of the mechanization of coal mining. They're still mining lots of coal there, but they don't need as many people to do it. So if you really want to support the coal miners, you'll get them back underground and stop mountaintop removal mining.
Yeah, I'm with you. I used to joke as a young man, you know, back in the 80s, that having gone through West Virginia the first time in my life, I grew up in Cleveland, which is relatively flat, and I used to joke that what they should do is they should just make West Virginia flat. Either you call it the garbage state and level it off, or just flatten it out. I didn't realize they were taking my joke seriously and actually blowing these mountains off, completely gone.
Well, then that's been the trend in recent years. And it's leaving a ravaged landscape and impoverished people and poisoned waters. And, you know, it's a very difficult situation over there. And this is what I wanted to highlight in my novel. I took a situation very similar to the accident at Buffalo Creek, where a break of an impoundment dam, this is real, of course. This was in 1972, in February of 1972. An impoundment dam broke, and this massive wall of water came down the hollow and took out the next dam and took out the next dam. And the water from the three of these dams swept through this 20-mile-long hollow and killed 125 people in a matter of just a few minutes and basically destroyed everything in its wake. And so I've taken a similar situation, a fictional situation, where some of the survivors of the flood attempt to extract justice from the people whose negligence caused this. And it was my way of illustrating some of the issues that face people now in southern West Virginia in the coal field.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're Michael Abraham, author of War, West Virginia, a novel of the quest for justice in the Appalachian coalfields. We've got a link at therickssmithshow.com of how you can pick up a copy of the book. I'll just click on Michael Abraham's name. It'll take you right there. You know, I've seen a number of these kind of books just popping up recently. You know, one was just sent to me the other day. We had gone through Cherry and Verdin, Illinois. And, you know, one of the folks that we met there had written a book, almost the same exact thing, taking historical times and putting, you know, real-life kind of people into these situations to kind of show us what things were like back then. And, you know, it kind of got me thinking a little bit of the right-wing frame that, you know, unions were something we needed 100 years ago. We don't need them anymore. And, you know, as I'm reading these books now, I'm going, man, it sounds an awful lot like today what went on back then, only we seem to cover it up a lot better today.
I'm not sure covering it up is the right way to look at it. You know, it's certainly we have a difficult time extracting any kind of justice. You know, when a company like Freedom that you mentioned earlier has this horrific accident that ruins the lives of 300,000 people, and they pretty much get off scot-free just by declaring bankruptcy, you know, what they're doing is they are privatizing the profit, and they are socializing the risk.
Yep.
And so everybody there is just screwed. You know, I'm sorry, drinking water doesn't work anymore. Incidentally, the company that supplies them the drinking water is a private company. They're still charging people for this water, even though they're not consuming it anymore and they can't drink it. You know, it's a horrible situation. And because West Virginia is a wholly owned subsidiary of the coal industry, it's virtually impossible for the legislature or the regulators to put anything in place that would prevent it from happening again. Because, I mean, regulation is only as good as the regulators.
Right. Well, no, I look at what's going on in West Virginia right now as a cautionary tale. I mean, if we're not going to learn from our own history here in Pennsylvania of the coal fields during, you know, 100 years ago, maybe we'll learn what's going on right now in West Virginia and other places.
Well, you know, I like to say that we're all downstream from West Virginia. And in a way, it's a metaphor. In a way, it's the truth, because it's the birthplace of rivers. Many of the East Coast rivers emanate in West Virginia. You know, my own New River, where my drinking water comes from in Blacksburg, Virginia, flows right through downtown Charleston, becomes the Kanawha, the primary tributary, I guess, is Kanawha. And then the Elk River is where this spill happens, which feeds into the Kanawha. You know, so and then, of course, downstream, one of the other issues I think that's interesting to think about and talk about is that this was a tank that contained many, many tens of thousands of gallons. They think that approximately 7,500 to 10,000 gallons of this chemical, MCHM, actually hit the river.
Right.
I mean, what percentage of that actually went into the water supply? Maybe 10%, 5%, 3%? And it was enough to poison the water supply for 300,000 people. Let's talk about the amount of this chemical that's used in everyday service and placed throughout the coal fields in its proper use, which is the preparation and cleaning of coal. Then what happens to it? Okay, is it injected underground? Is it put in these impoundment dams like what I describe in my book? And how many thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of gallons of this stuff are we creating? And is it biodegradable? I mean, what happens to it when it's used properly? I mean, I don't even think we know that. And this is one chemical out of probably, somewhere I heard the number of 83,000 unregulated or underregulated chemicals.
Yeah, I was going to say at least tens of thousands.
You know, so what happens to this stuff? If it's held in these impoundment dams, what happens to the wildlife? What happens? I mean, you know, these impoundment dams are primarily earthen dams. Don't picture in your mind something like the Hoover Dam. Picture just a big mound of debris, of rock, that's piled up at the head of a hollow, and this stuff, you know, flows in along with the water, flows in behind it. What do we have to decommission that stuff? And will we ever know the biodegradability or the long-term health effects of these tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of gallons of this stuff that we're sprinkling about the landscape? And the regulation is nowhere close to what it needs to be to keep up with the manufacturers of these chemicals. We just don't know what the health risks are. But we do know that in McDowell County, West Virginia, men are dying 15 years younger than they are in Fairfax County, Virginia. You know, it's killing people. You know, when you can't drink the water out of your tap in America, you know, in the 21st century, I think it's a national disgrace.
I'm with you. And, you know, the other thing that we don't even talk about, life expectancy is one thing, but what about quality of life? I mean,
quality of life. The quality of life there is so difficult. You know, I'll give you another statistic. I heard that over 60% of the houses still straight pipe their sewage to the creek in McDowell County, West Virginia.
Wow.
Okay.
Well, I mean, how much worse can that be than what they're pumping in from Freedom Industries, or how many other companies like that are spewing in off the grid?
Sure. But again, this is not, you know, Bolivia or Zimbabwe or someplace. This is West Virginia, the United States of America. You know, and the rest of us are in a sense are beneficiaries of this. My power company, American Electric Power, Appalachian Power Company, is primary fuel source is coal. So again, in the metaphor, you know, that we're all downhill, we're all downstream of West Virginia. You know, because what happens there, it doesn't just happen there. We're all part of it.
And that's the thing that division that they like to keep us separated and away from each other, that kind of plays into this. Let me ask you last line of questioning. You know, now that you've written the book, what kind of response have you gotten from it?
Well, I think it's the same response that people have to a number of situations that seem tragic and beyond their control. You know, I sort of try to build a happy ending in the sense that some of my survivors here attempt to get justice, and there is some payback at some level. But, you know, what I'm trying to do is highlight the plight of this situation. Again, I think what struck me so is that it's so close to so many people throughout the East Coast. You know, the coal fields of West Virginia are within a day's drive of probably half the population of America. It's not very far away. So, you know, read the book, come there and see what it looks like, see the situation, meet the people. You know, the people are, you know, trying to make the best of their situation. But it's such a difficult place because everybody's moving out. There's literally thousands of abandoned structures, abandoned homes, homes, tipples, churches, stores. One woman was quoted as saying, you know, I'm a fairly gregarious person. I can meet people. I can make friends, but I can't make old friends. And the old friends are leaving.
Right.
And so, you know, come see these people and see how your neighbors are living. You know, read the book, hopefully. Read my other books, too, you know, because they're all of my novels deal with some element of social issues, social justice. You know, I can't figure out how to write disjunct novels.
Yeah, well, good, because if you're going to read something, at least something that'll make you want to change the world a little bit. Again, the book is War, West Virginia, a novel of the quest for justice in the Appalachian coal fields. We've got a link to the book at thericksmithshow.com where you can pick it up. Just click on Michael Abrams' name. It'll take you right there. Michael, I appreciate you taking time for us.
Oh, it's great to talk to you, and thank you so much for your time.
Thanks so much for your input and your thoughts. Let's take a quick break right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith. The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
Tales of American Political History with Clinton Porter Hackney.
We've been talking about the president's office of the press secretary and who the first one might have been. When we last talked, I challenged you to pick from one of six men who I can argue was our first real press secretary. First of all, presidents in the early days had few to none when it came to assistants. There wasn't much money, there wasn't much media, and there weren't really all that many American citizens. The first president appropriated money for a staff was Ulysses Grant, who had all of six staffers. Even as late as Calvin Coolidge in the 1920s, the president had less than 50 people on staff at a cost of less than $100,000. But along the trail of American presidents, it was always important to engage the news media. So join us again for the early candidates for the first presidential press secretary. This is Clinton Porter Hackney at cphackney.com.
Tenacity can be a virtue, but the persistent push by giant food conglomerates to deceive us consumers has turned their tenacity into raw mendacity. Brand-name food peddlers are spending hundreds of millions of dollars on lobbyists, lawyers, campaign donations, PR hypesters, and political manipulators so they can genetically and dangerously alter the dinner we put on our family tables without bothering to tell us which items they've messed with. With practically no public notice, their first deception was to get Washington to okay the production and introduction of genetically modified organisms into corn, canola, soy, and other crops. Then they quietly pushed to prevent federal regulators from requiring that these tampered Frankenfoods be labeled as containing GMOs. Next, they tried a grand deception, insisting that foods tainted with GMOs qualify for the national organic label. Even our usually submissive regulators balked at that one. But look out, for here they come again. Big Foods Industry Front Group, the Grocery Manufacturers Association, is now demanding that foods with genetically engineered ingredients be allowed to use the word natural on their packages. Natural? Let's see. One, these biotech mutations are not products of nature, but of corporate technicians. And two, the plants are manufactured in corporate labs by extracting genes from a foreign plant or even an animal, then splicing those genes into the manufactured creature. The very DNA of this man-made food is altered, with no understanding of the long-term environmental or health consequences. This is Jim Hightower saying, a Twinkie is more natural than that. They're perverting both our language and nature's reality. To oppose these profiteers' tenacious mendaciousness, contact the Environmental Working Group. That's at www.ewg.org.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Right now, we are hard at work to bring a major natural gas processing plant to southwestern Pennsylvania. The best argument we can make to the company behind the project is Pennsylvania's embrace of free markets.
Yes, free markets, yes, that's why, free markets. It's not the free money, no, not that at all. No, don't worry about that. Don't worry about the free money, no. It's those market thingies that they keep telling us. If we just let them be free enough, everything would be wonderful. If we just gave enough tax breaks, if we just handed out enough money to the very well-to-do. Because after all, right, I mean, this is how it works. After all, they know what to do with it, right? Bill Gates knows what to do with money, right? And I don't disagree. I think he does. I think he knows how to make money. He absolutely does. Not for you or me or society, but for himself and for his company. You got to give him credit for that. And you got to give entrepreneurs credit who take the new widget and they do create the next latest greatest thing. You give them credit for that. I don't know that we give them our children's future, but, you know, Credit is where it's due. And we've given all of these tax breaks, massive amounts of tax breaks, under the guise that, and the promise that they'll create jobs. And, you know, you look around and you see the trillions of dollars being parked overseas. You see the trillions of dollars that are, as the Republicans put it, on the sidelines. On the sidelines. I like that. You know why they're keeping the money on the sidelines? Because there's a lot of stuff up for sale soon. If you can starve government enough, you've got people who say, let's privatize everything. Like our governor. Let's privatize the wine and spirit shops. Let's privatize the lottery. Let's privatize education. Let's privatize the things that make decent money for the Commonwealth and for states. and then make it even more. Our stat of the day comes from the folks over at the Too Much Online blog. If the $26.7 billion Wall Streeters collected in bonuses last year had gone instead to minimum wage workers, the folks over at the Institute for Policy and Studies calculates that America's GDP would have grown by about $32.3 billion, over triple the $10.4 billion boost the standard economic multiplier model credits to the Wall Street bonuses. Understand, they come up with this model that says if we give all this money to the Wall Street people, because you know what, they earned it. Yeah, by taking it from your pensions. They earned it, yes. So they put it in their pocket, and they got to buy big homes and yachts and vacation places and fancy cars and jewelry and paintings and all the wonderful things that keep our economy going. If we give it to them, the economic activity will boost about an additional $10.4 billion. Now, if you do what I've been saying from day one on the air as someone who's in the work, solidly in the working class, and say, you know what, you give it to the people who earned it, you know, had you divvied up that $15 billion the fast food industry pocketed last year, had you divvied up, half of it to the workforce, what kind of a stimulus would that have been for those workers? Would it have made their lives better? And I argue yes. Not only would it have made their lives better, it would have made other people's lives better as well. And this analysis by this Sarah Anderson at the Institute for Policy Studies kind of bears that out. You give the very well-to-do money, and there's some activity. But if you give it to the rest of us, it's triple. Again, no surprise here. But it is what it is, I guess. But not surprising, in my view. Anyway, I came across this article over at Politico today. The title of the article, The Rich Strike Back. Because, you know, the rich, they feel they're under attack. Because you've got, you know, Democrats, mostly. And not all Democrats, just, you know, some of them saying, you know, back during the fabulous 50s, the wonderful golden age of the middle class, the Norman Rockwell 50s, where people pine for the return of family values and all of those things that the 50s are equated with, of which, you know, I'm with you. I'd love to see a lot of the things that the 50s were famous for come back again. The whole family values thing, I'm down with that. I love the idea of having one income earner being able to support a family, and that there be someone at home when the kids come home from school to be there to do the homework and take them to the practices and make brownies or whatever the hell else you do. In favor of it, absolutely good idea. What we've got, not so much the June Cleaver, Leave It to Beaver scenario that the 50s led us to believe was going on. What we've got now is we've got two people who are struggling, working their behinds off, too tired to go to the basketball game after school, and kids who were, you know, in their own little world sometimes. Not quite the fabulous 50s that we're led to believe. And this done really by the people who tell us that they believe in family values, right? So now Politico has announced, yes, the rich are going to start fighting back, because Bill de Blasio, the mayor of New York City, and this is, they wrote this, you can't make it up, just a few months ago, it looked like 2014 would be the year of the populist, with Democrats running on economic inequality, Tea Party Republicans bashing banks, and newly minted New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio pledging to soak the rich with higher taxes. Now, I gotta be honest, I don't think that there's anyone saying we should be soaking the rich. I think we should be saying, is it good for society that you have a tax rate for folks who have the resources that benefits all of society that we can then go, you know, we used to have schools that were fully funded, and they did pretty well. We used to have colleges and universities that were funded, where working class kids could rise up out of poverty or out of working class roots, and, oh, I don't know, rise up do better. Make the next widget. Make the next new invention. Get us to the moon, whatever. And, oh, by the way, speaking of going to the moon, we used to, as a society, invest in technology and in things for the future. You know, when I took the kids to Disneyland a couple years ago for Christmas, I was on one of the little fab train things, which I love their public transportation system. You didn't have to drive anywhere. You got on the little train, takes you wherever you want, all over numerous parks. Cities could learn a lot from Disney World. Now, understand, you know, you pay a lot to get in there, so you better be moving around pretty efficiently. But public transportation systems could learn a bit from that. Ran on time. Everything was wonderful. But I remember, you know, talking with several of the folks on the train, and one guy in particular stuck out in my mind. He actually worked for NASA for his entire life. His entire working career was a NASA scientist. And he was fascinating. Just an incredibly fascinating guy, saying, do you know all the things that came out of our investment in going to the moon? I mean, not just Tang and some of the other microwaves and the other stuff, but he listed off probably 100 things on the blink of an eye of things that came out of our investment in space technology. Our investment in trying to say, hey, you know what? We need to get something that's not going to burn up when it comes through the atmosphere. Maybe we could, you know, come up with something. And that investment thrown into the quote-unquote private sector of people who said, well, I think I can do that. And that entrepreneurial energy that came about of people going, let's compete, let's do this well, let's make the next widget. Let's figure out how to do things differently. Our investment into the space program benefited wildly corporate America, which then paid decent wages. Money stayed local. Projects stayed local. People did well. You know, I think of the Navy chair. I interviewed a guy not too long ago who his grandfather started this company that the Department of the Navy said, hey, we need a chair that we can put on our submarines and on our ships that doesn't weigh a lot, but it's got to be virtually indestructible. And they came up with this really sharp, polished aluminum chair that was really virtually indestructible. And he said when his grandfather sold it to the Navy, he opened up like a sixth-floor window, and he threw it out the window and had someone down there waiting for it, hit the ground, brought it back up, had barely a scratch on it. And that chair has been in production ever since, and now the Chinese evidently are stealing the design and making it for, you know, a tenth of the cost, but again, nowhere the strength. Now, I don't know if you need an indestructible chair, but that's what our investment did. And this guy on the train at Disneyland went through all of these advancements that we're not going to be doing in the future because we're not investing in the next technologies, or at least not at the rate that I think we should be. Now, even some of my most far-out Tea Party folks, they seem to understand that, you know, when no one else is going to invest in tomorrow's technology, someone has to. And it has to be us. You know, we hear an awful lot of this about me, hooray for me. My company, me. Never a lot about we. And that's kind of frustrating. But anyway, I go back to this Politico article saying, you know, the rich, they're going to fight back. And I'm going, really? They're going to fight back? Haven't they been beating us for 40 years? I mean, when you control the mainstream corporate-controlled media, when you control the levers of power, when you control our government, when you control the politicians and the entire structure, what do you mean they're going to start to fight back? They're going to strike back? Is this the next Star Wars movie? The rich strike back! And, you know, I just kind of... And I remember this a couple of years ago. My uncle, who's a fairly well-to-do guy, this idea that we would expect them to pay more in taxes, like they used to, he took personally. And, you know, then you know the whole vow of I'm not going to do charitable work and all of that stuff came out. Part of me goes, you know, they've for so long had this patriarchal mentality that they carry this country, and if it weren't for them, that we should be grateful to them for what we have is very odd to me. Because at the end of the day, their skill, their ability to produce is because of you, is because of me, is because of the people who actually physically do the work. And I truly believe that one cannot exist without the other. But at the end of the day, if the CEO class, the investor class weren't here, someone would fill that role. I truly believe that. But you look at all of this pushing back, and it's scary times. And I'm hoping that we wake up and we go, you know what? We do need more of an economic populist. We do need to make sure that the wealth is spread a little bit. And yes, I am talking about redistribution of wealth through higher wages, through people working, and through jobs programs. We need to do away with handout programs and get jobs programs. I'm all in favor of that, which is something we should have been doing for years anyway. But again, you've got a political party who need their scapegoats, and another political party who relies on, hey, we need to make sure that we take care of the poor. Instead of doing that, maybe we should be talking about, hey, how do we give people the dignity and the self-respect that comes from working for a living? Just a thought. And, you know, when the Paul Ryans of the world say, well, there are generations who don't want to work. That's nonsense. Absolute nonsense. People need to find jobs. We have a jobs crisis in this country. And we need to be producing more jobs. And if corporate America won't do it, if corporate America can't do it, you know who's got to do it? That's right. You and me. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Listening to The Rick Smith Show. It's The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
13,000 patient healthcare workers at the University of California could be on strike March 24th. The workers took a strike vote, and 97% of them approved a five-day strike to start March 24th. AFSCME Local 3299 says the strike is an unfair labor practices strike triggered by UC's imposing contract terms that includes healthcare benefit cuts. The union also takes exception to an emergency layoff clause in UC's contract proposal. AFSCME calls that a poison pill. The workers want to reach a fair negotiated contract settlement with UC, and AFSCME is calling on the university to stop unfair labor practices. AFSCME 3299 was able to reach an agreement with UC for thousands of service workers back in February, averting a five-day strike that had been planned then. If these patient care workers strike for 5 days now, it could cost UC as much as $50 million, according to the university. A major restructuring of the Canadian Pacific Railway could cut as many as 4,500 jobs. Phil Qualley of Minnesota's United Transportation Union says that poses a big potential safety problem that can't be ignored.
We're seeing a trend where more and more freight is being moved with less people, and any way you take away people from the right-of-ways of the American railroads, you're losing hands-on inspections of moving trains, of track. Mechanical and track inspections are absolutely essential to the interest of public safety. We want to guard against needless alarmism. However, we want to encourage that all parties move with urgency to protect public safety.
New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio is trying to figure out how to make good on back pay for the city's teachers union without creating financial problems for the city. The teachers have been working without a contract for 4.5 years. The union is seeking a new labor contract and will want to make up the back pay. The city is having trouble coming up with the $3.4 billion that it will cost for 2 of the years teachers have been working without a contract. Mayor de Blasio is proposing a 9-year contract deal to stretch the back wage payments over a longer time period. A deal with teachers is just part of the picture. Mayor de Blasio is also working on a comprehensive approach to negotiating deals with all of New York City's labor unions who were unable to reach agreements with former Mayor Michael Bloomberg.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
The Workers' Independent News is brought to you with support from the Bank of Labor, a division of Brotherhood Bank and Trust, member FDIC, equal opportunity lender. Union-owned, union-represented Bank of Labor offers a business Visa card with no annual fee and points earned with every purchase, along with rental vehicle and travel accident insurance. Online at bankoflabor.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. The website, therickssmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick, at therickssmithshow.com. So the news today coming from the Ukraine, Ukrainian officer killed in what the prime minister is calling a war crime and is actually now calling for international talks to make sure that this doesn't happen again and that maybe you find out who did it and hold them responsible. But this, you know, when you look at what's going on over there, it takes me back to my childhood, which is why we've asked former Congressman and former Admiral Joe Sestak to come talk to us about what's going on in Crimea and in the Ukraine. Joe, thanks for taking time for us.
It's good to be with you, Rick. Thank you.
You know, I remember, you know, back in November when a lot of this broke, there were the protests in Kiev, and I remember having a guest on going, hey, could this possibly turn into one of those Cold War era push-pulls over a third area that the U.S. and the Soviet Union used to get into? And I was told, no, couldn't possibly get there. Question is, Joe, are we there?
Well, we're not quite to that extent yet. And we have to keep in mind that Russia's military has some spots of excellence, but on the whole, it is almost like a third country military, except for its nuclear capability. So we have to proceed with caution here, but yet we can still proceed with strength. And our greatest strength is going to be first to reassure all our NATO allies. And those republics that used to be part of the Soviet Union and give us basing rights, that we are there. Number two, we have to ensure that Putin pays for his misbehavior. Look, it is really just a gas station. That's all Russia is today. 80% of all of its rubles, all of its currency that it gets comes from selling oil and gas. And its Eastern Siberian field is about to run out within the next decade of natural gas. And they need to now develop the very cold, hard tundra of the western part of Siberia. And they need our technology, our companies to do that. You know, we shouldn't be doing it. And we should begin to export and start to sell them our gas, them being Western Europe that's relying upon them. This makes a long-term strategy to where Putin begins to understand that his irrational behavior is not going to be accepted.
Do we have the ability to have the economic levers to make Putin pay? I mean, as I look at our exports, as I look at our trade with Russia, it would appear to me that the Europe would have the greater economic levers to be able to make him pay. I don't know that we so much do. Your thoughts?
Well, you're right. As far as Germany and the United Kingdom has a lot of trade going on with them. But what we have is the United States Treasury. And what we want to hurt are not Russians. We want to hurt the cronies that have billions of dollars stashed in Western economies. We want to begin to make sure that we freeze their assets. We want to begin to bring our laws against the crimes that they perpetrated upon the Russians in order to make their money. And under the laws of the international world, we can then freeze their assets. That's where our economic, it's really our financial prowess comes. But then we build our first LG, gas terminal to export. We're just finishing it and beginning to do so down in the south. We need to begin to wean Western Europe, which gets 25% of its natural gas from Russia, and get them to buy ours. And that then gets to any kind of future income that Russia has. So it's a 1-2. Short-term, Treasury begins to clamp down on the corrupt officials and their assets. And longer-term, we make sure that Russia isn't going to have an income because of natural gas and oil that we begin to provide to the world. And they then begin to understand you got to behave correctly.
Well, let me ask you this, there's been a lot of talk. I saw Sarah Palin say that that Putin wrestles bears and walks around without his shirt on, and Obama, he wears mommy jeans. To me, it just seems to be sending the wrong message. Do you think what the president's done so far has been in the right direction? Because as you pointed out, I mean, I think the executive order he signed targeted 22 individuals having their assets frozen and their travel restricted. Are you seeing that as a step in the right direction of what you're saying?
Yes, it is. And let's keep in mind this. We used to have, when crises happened, partisanship stopped at the water's edge. We used to be unified when we addressed crises overseas. And while we may have voiced our opinion, we never took on the leader of the free world personally. And then you see that, I mean, right here in Pennsylvania, one of our senators called President Obama tepid last week in his response. And then he stood quietly by while one party, the minority party, the Republicans in the Senate, wouldn't even pass the sanctions bill, the loan guarantees, the support for democracy that we wanted to give Ukraine. In fact, Senator McCain came on the floor and said, you Republicans are not Reagan Republicans. We should be unified in this crisis as we go overseas. So I want to make sure we put in perspective that one of the worst things we have going down today is the divisiveness in America. Now to put that into our foreign policy approaches, I think is inexcusable.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Because, you know, growing up during the Cold War era, the one thing why you saw the parties differ and bicker when it came to anything having to do with the USSR, they were unified. If you could give them credit for anything, on that they were.
Absolutely. And, you know, we need to make sure that we understand that this is no retrenchment from the United States of America or NATO. As I said, there has been a consistent Western movement of democracy in NATO countries over there, from Poland to Estonia and Latvia, both of those republics, part of the former Soviet Union. We have basing in five of the Central Asian republics that used to be part of the Soviet Union. It's Putin who's feeling entrenched, I believe. And so he has taken advantage of a very Russian-heavy ethnic population in the Crimea in order to annex it. Now, are we going to accept it? Absolutely not. We can make him and his cronies hurt economically, diplomatically. It'll take time. But I'm a firm believer that while the military option for our security is never off the table, it's in the back of the table as we successfully make them hurt. Them being those cronies that are actually stealing money from their own people, from the only wealth they have right now because of the cronyism, oil and gas exports.
I'm with you. I saw today a story that we're actually considering doing what you're saying, doing some military exercises in the Baltics right now so that Russia's neighbors maybe get a little sense of, hey, we might be next, but there might be some help as well.
Absolutely. And again, I want to make sure people understand, as you well do, that we can never treat the Russian bear lightly because he does have nuclear weapons and he does have some elements of excellence. But I'll never forget being in the Persian Gulf when a Russian ship pulled in, one of its best cruisers, and it sat there for 6 months, never getting underway because they couldn't afford for it to get away. And when you went on underway, they couldn't afford the gas. Number two, when you went through that ship, boy, was it hurt. Its readiness with no training ever being done means that it is extremely, extremely poor warfare readiness. And they have not improved in the last 10 years. That's why we also have to make sure that countries like France that were about to sell two helicopter carriers to Russia, we kind of say, wait a minute here. No munitions go to a country that won't even respect international norms.
Yeah, I'm with you. What does it say about us, the global sales trade, if we're going to be selling these kind of things? Wow, that's something I had not heard. But, you know, as you look at this, and I had someone email me yesterday going, are we seeing Putin trying to revive the Brezhnev Doctrine, trying to pull the old Soviet Union back together, and by any means possible? And I don't know that, listening to what you're saying, I don't know that that's possible.
It is impossible. Look, every single republic of the former Soviet Union, every single Eastern European country that is now in NATO, we are committed to defend, and we will. This is Ukraine. Ukraine's officers were the best. Because only officers that were of the Slavic descent Ukraine, and Russia, and Belarus were allowed to command the Soviet army. That's why there's such a close tie, and they moved many of the Russians into that. Look, should we accept this? Absolutely not. But does this mean it's a reformation of the former Soviet Union under the name of Russia? Absolutely not. And as we proceed to make sure they pay for what they did so that they do get back on board with international norms, let's keep in mind this, Rick. We have other interests that we want to work with Russia. We want it to continue to be with us as we apply sanctions on Iran so it doesn't get a nuclear weapon. We want to make sure those chemical weapons that are in Syria, that Russia did begin the process to eliminate and get them out of there, continues. And third, there's only two ways out of Afghanistan that we want all our forces and equipment out of by the end of 2014. One's to Pakistan. And a year ago, they closed the road out. And the only other way for us to get out was what's called the Northern Distribution Network. And a vast majority of that network, those roads, goes right through Russia. And so we have to keep these other interests in mind as we proceed to make sure they pay, but also to make sure that we work it so all our interests are addressed appropriately.
So then maybe you can look at this as an opportunity to, A, take the Crimea for themselves, but also use some leverage to get some, like North Korea does, to get something in return, act up a little bit, get something, get some kind of lucrative deal out of it.
Look, we will never accept that they have annexed Crimea. Never. Nor should we ever. And what's eventually going to happen, I am certain, that if we are able to buttress Ukraine and get it to be a viable economy again, and to get it to be one where it feels comfortable, that it has the training, the democratic institutions to stand strong, so that the movement by Putin is shown to be hollow. And oh, by the way, remember, all the water that's provided to the Crimea comes from Ukraine, as well as its natural gas. And so you eventually can say, look, Ukraine is coming up online as a viable entity. People want to belong there, want to, and proud of it. Then you begin to see that the Russians say to Putin, maybe that's what we want. And we don't want the United States taking away the selling of our natural gas by opening up our spigot so that eventually Ukraine, Poland, UK, and Germany all are buying from us and not that country. Look, this is a tough one. You know, we have a hard enough time here at home trying to control Congress. It's pretty tough to control Ukraine, which used to be in the Crimea, that used to be in the Soviet Union. But we've got a lot of levers to pull, and we need to do it well.
Right.
And that's why I'm so disappointed when that sanctions bill stalled last week. As John McCain said to his own party, you're not Reagan Republicans if you can't pass this bill. And that's why I was so disappointed that we didn't have a unified front on our approach to the Ukraine crisis.
Which is why I think it's so important that folks hear what Sarah Palin had to say, this admiration of Putin while putting down our president. He wrestles bears and walks around without a shirt on, and our guy wears mommy jeans. To me, just absolutely internationally the wrong message. Let me ask you this, Joe. You know, in looking at the vote that just happened, 93% of the people in Crimea voted to move to Russia. Do we put any validity in that? Because I've talked to some people who were there saying that, you know, the ballot boxes were clear plastic boxes, that they had printed double the amount of ballots needed. Do we put any validity in this election at all?
Absolutely not. Alone, there's 300,000 Tatars that never did vote into it. A different type of ethnicity there in Crimea. And even if it were to be a true vote, never would we validate that. A vote that was rushed through the middle of the night, there's no doubt in anyone's mind that this was a prostitution of the democratic process. It doesn't even belong in the same room as the word democracy. And so, no, I think that what we have to do is bring the world together as a whole and make sure that slowly and surely they understand that Crimea is going to suffer because it's not going to get the goods it needs. I mean, many of them work in Ukraine and come to Crimea. And so what we have to do is slowly, with strength, apply long-term sanctions, like I talked about, on natural gas and oil, and that they will not get our technology to develop their future fields, they being Russia. But in the meantime, we have to be quick. supply sanctions by our Treasury Department on the corrupt means by which and gains by which the Russian cronies, Putin's allies in the Kremlin, can be hurt, as well as those Ukrainians in Crimea who went with the sides of Putin. We need to strap down hard their assets here. Doing it legally, but be quick to do it.
And again, as you pointed out, pull in all of our allies internationally to put the same kind of pressure on. I want to ask you about President Clinton. He was recorded saying that Putin is a highly intelligent guy with a skewed perception of Russian greatness, and it was his assessment that you'd be brutal with him in private, but you don't go out and embarrass him in public. And I got to wonder, do we have the right guy in the White House right now to do just that and not be out on the front chest thumping and with the heated rhetoric that I would expect from the Bush era?
Yes, look, I have not always agreed with President Obama's approach to every foreign crisis. I think we should have been more quick to address Syria. I think he's approached Iran spot on. In this case, I want to make sure people understand that, as you do, that we have to approach this in a very thoughtful way, but one with strength that leads with economic or financial ability to crimp down on the assets that the corrupt officials in the Kremlin have taken from their people. But this is not a time to begin to talk about our military that's going to go around and whack-a-mole the world. This is one where speak strongly but carry a big stick, and that stick we're carrying that we should be using is the only thing that's keeping Russia from being a failed third world country. And that's its oil and its gas reserves. And we've got to clamp down on that gas station so that they do not, over time, have very many customers coming to them. That's what's going to make them hurt. And any kind of money that they've gotten from those gains that these corrupt officials have, making sure that they're not going to be pulled back into Russia, we're going to keep them over here under lock and key until the behavior changes. That's the right approach.
Yes, let me ask you then, last line of questioning. You hear a lot of the Republicans saying this is a very, we passed the Keystone XL and we drill, baby, drill. Is that what we're advocating?
No. What we have right now, where 4 or 5 years ago, the price of natural gas was, I'd say per energy of unit, about four times what it would for the same energy per unit of coal. Today, it's as cheap, if not cheaper, than coal. And it's going to continue to go down and be more bountiful, not just because of the Marcellus Shale, let's say, here in Pennsylvania, but the Utica Shale that's underneath it. We're going to be able to sell gas because we're going to have more than we need to the world. So in my mind, we have to do it right. We have to close the Halliburton loophole that didn't permit the EPA to oversee clean drinking water, safe, clean water, to make sure that we do it right. But in my mind, this is an ability for us, since we're already doing it, to begin to export to the world, not just to Russia, to Western Europe, but also to countries like China and others that are spewing 500 new coal emission plants that are twice as toxic to the environment as natural gas is. So we got to do this, but we got to do it wisely. I believe that we have several elements of our power, Rick. The military is one, but economics, financial, diplomacy, and economics, by the power of what we have bountiful underneath us, done well, as we over time transition to renewable energy, in my mind, is a tool that we need to use.
I'm with you. All righty. I appreciate the time, Joe. I feel a little bit better about our position. Kind of on the same wavelength. But I hope our listeners got something out of it. Joe Sestak, I appreciate you taking time for us.
Rick, thanks for having me, and have a great evening.
You too. We'll talk again real soon. Let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We can live in harmony.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
This is
is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Albert Klein. The Obama administration has begun working with the Commerce Department on transitioning the third-party oversight of the Internet, a plan that has been in place since 1998. However, Fox News hosts use this opportunity to falsely claim that President Obama is giving away the Internet. On Fox's America's News host Greg Jarrett said,
in the 1960s, this thing was developed with American money by the Department of Defense. Taxpayers paid for this whole thing. So why should the Obama administration or one president make a decision to give away something that has been probably one of the greatest world inventions ever by Americans?
As the New York Times explained, the U.S. has been subcontracting the assignment of Internet addresses to the Internet Corporation for assigned names and numbers since 1998. ICANN was created as an international nonprofit organization with the expectation that the U.S. would eventually step back from its role. For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
Tenacity can be a virtue, but the persistent push by giant food conglomerates to deceive us consumers has turned their tenacity into raw mendacity. Brand-name food peddlers are spending hundreds of millions of dollars on lobbyists, lawyers, campaign donations, PR hypesters, and political manipulators so they can genetically and dangerously alter the dinner we put on our family tables without bothering to tell us which items they've messed with. With practically no public notice, their first deception was to get Washington to okay the production and introduction of genetically modified organisms into corn, canola, soy, and other crops. Then, they quietly pushed to prevent federal regulators from requiring that these tampered Frankenfoods be labeled as containing GMOs. Next, they tried a grand deception, insisting that foods tainted with GMOs qualify for the national organic label. Even our usually submissive regulators balked at that one. But look out, for here they come again. Big Foods Industry Front Group, the Grocery Manufacturers Association, is now demanding that foods with genetically engineered ingredients be allowed to use the word natural on their packages. Natural? Let's see. One, these biotech mutations are not products of nature, but of corporate technicians. And two, the plants are manufactured in corporate labs by extracting genes from a foreign plant or even an animal, then splicing those genes into the manufactured creature. The very DNA of this man-made food is altered, with no understanding of the long-term environmental or health consequences. This is Jim Hightower saying, a Twinkie is more natural than that. They're perverting both our language and nature's reality. To oppose these profiteers' tenacious mendaciousness, contact the Environmental Working Group. That's at www.ewg.org.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Our nation enters this conflict reluctantly, yet our purpose is sure. The people of the United States and our friends and allies will not live at the mercy of an outlaw regime that threatens the peace with weapons of mass murder. We will meet that threat now with our Army, Air Force, Navy, Coast Guard, and Marines, so that we do not have to meet it later with armies of firefighters and police and doctors on the streets of our cities. Now that conflict has come, the only way to limit its duration is to apply decisive force.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. You know, I go back to that, and, you know, again, you know, there's a part of this to me that goes, you know, having grown up during that period, during the Cold War, where you saw these things popping up, and you saw the push and the pull, and you saw politicians then going, this is, on both sides of the aisle, this was nonpartisan, saying, you know, we need to be investing more, we need to be spending more on military and more. Right when this came up, you may remember me going, I just need to step back for a second and evaluate this. Is this one of those things that says, you know, the military-industrial complex is going, hey, we're crying poverty. You had Hagel saying, we're now having, you know, troop levels lower than before World War II, and we're not making this aircraft carrier or the engine for this plane or for this or that. And all of this, all of the military-industrial complex saying, well, you know, we need more. And, you know, so part of me stopped and said, you know, I want to think this through a little bit. I want to make sure that I'm not being, you know, led to the execution, so to speak. And, you know, I look at this in a really a jaded eye as well. But I got a couple of emails of people questioning, you know, a couple of guests, you know, because yesterday we talked with Zach and Luke from Talk Radio News Service, and Zach is actually in the Ukraine talking to people on the streets. And I got one email from Rich who said, you know, the two guys were on the show were full of it. You know, they're full of you-know-what. Rich claims that over 86% voted, 93% went with Russia. He said only teabag Americans want austerity, and I agree with that. Only the teabaggers want the austerity. I just don't know what that here. He said, Rick, no reports at all of voter intimidation, none. And I find that really extraordinarily difficult to believe. Now, Rich says, you know, it's the Creel Commission all over again. And you may remember going back to Woodrow Wilson, World War One, you know, the creation of this Committee on Public Information, propaganda wing, you know, where they started up these, you know, these different operations to, you know, to keep people overly misinformed, kind of like the Fox News of the day, if you will. And, you know, he goes on to say, look, you know, look at the bright side. Lots of Americans are going to find jobs in the defense industry, not as many that found work during the Cold War. America is now outsourcing defense work. And he points out, and this I did not know, and I'm going to have to check on it. Putin passed a law, according to Rich, a couple of months ago that all military spending must be spent in Russia. That I did not know. I'm going to have to look at it. And he finishes up with, they got you. And I don't know that anybody got me, Rich, but I look at this, and I think I've been very clear with a very jaundiced eye of what is going on. But I can't imagine 93% of anyone saying, yeah, we want this or that. Now, I understand Crimea is heavily Russian, but I can't imagine that they would say, yeah, we want to break away from here to go with there without there being something. Now, I'm sure they promised them the world and you know, red ribbon tied around it and all of that. But I'm not, 93% just seems really, really high. I would have thought, you know, 60, 70, no, I wouldn't have questioned 93%, really high. Anyway, it is what it is. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show.
Changing America for the better.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
13,000 patient healthcare workers at the University of California could be on strike March 24th. The workers took a strike vote, and 97% of them approved a 5-day strike to start March 24th. AFSCME Local 3299 says the strike is an unfair labor practices strike triggered by UC's imposing contract terms that includes health care benefit cuts. The union also takes exception to an emergency layoff clause in UC's contract proposal. AFSCME calls that a poison pill. The workers want to reach a fair negotiated contract settlement with UC, and AFSCME is calling on the university to stop unfair labor practices. AFSCME 3299 was able to reach an agreement with UC for thousands of service workers back in February, averting a 5-day strike that had been planned then. If these patient care workers strike for 5 days now, it could cost UC as much as $50 million, according to the university. A major restructuring of the Canadian Pacific Railway could cut as many as 4,500 jobs. Phil Qualley of Minnesota's United Transportation Union says that poses a big potential safety problem that can't be ignored.
We're seeing a trend where more and more freight is being moved with less people, and any way you take away people from the right-of-ways of the American railroads, you are losing hands-on inspection. inspections of moving trains, of track. Mechanical and track inspections are absolutely essential to the interest of public safety. We want to guard against needless alarmism. However, we want to encourage that all parties move with urgency to protect public safety.
New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio is trying to figure out how to make good on back pay for the city's teachers union without creating financial problems for the city. The teachers have been working without a contract for 4.5 years. The union is seeking a new labor contract and will want to make up the back pay. The city is having trouble coming up with the $3.4 billion that it will cost for 2 of the years teachers have been working without a contract. Mayor de Blasio is proposing a 9-year contract deal to stretch the back wage payments over a longer time period. A deal with teachers is just part of the picture. Mayor de Blasio is also working on a comprehensive approach to negotiating deals with all of New York City's labor unions who were unable to reach agreements with former Mayor Michael Bloomberg.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
The Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from the Bank of Labor, a division of Brotherhood Bank and Trust, member FDIC, equal opportunity lender. Union-owned, union-represented Bank of Labor offers a business Visa card with no annual fee and points earned with every purchase, along with rental vehicle and travel accident insurance. Online at bankoflabor.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
We're not going to let people do school reform in the name of school reform in a way that makes the schools bad. Us educators have a real stake in that.
Open up your eyes. Yes. The quote of the day. I came across this quote of the day by Diane Ravitch, former U.S. Assistant Secretary of Education, also an author on numerous topics on education. But this quote of the day that catches my attention. Why destroy public education so that a handful of people can boast that they have a charter school in addition to their yacht? And, that is really perfect framing for me, because I look at someone like Bill Gates, who is out in the front of this whole push towards privatizing education. Someone sent me a video on Bill Gates pushing the Common Core on how it's going to make teachers freer and give them more opportunity to teach, and not just filling in bubbles either. And I'm going, that's not quite what I've heard. In fact, this whole push towards filling in the bubble seems to be the way all of education seems to be going. I'm not the expert here, which is why I've asked my next guest. Tim Slecker is the host or co-host of At the Chalk Face, at thechalkface.com, their website, a blog talk radio program, very popular, and also involved with the United Opt Out movement. Tim, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, no problem, Rick. Thanks a lot for having me on.
I look at this video that Bill Gates has put out about the Common Core, and basically saying the teachers are going to have more freedom. It's going to make our children wonderful critical thinkers. Basically everything that I've been told that it's not.
Right. Well, and he's absolutely not telling the truth. And for you to put that out there is great, because you got to go back to an earlier video, and I forget, it's either in 2009, where he specifically said, look, we're developing the Common Core standards so that the market can deliver curriculum, so that we can have the tests that we are going to be able to what he said at the time, validly measure progress. And therefore, but this was the catch, was that this was going to create a new education market. And so the whole reason for the Common Core standards was to develop tests. That's the whole purpose. The whole purpose of the standards was not about college and career readiness. That's a great catchphrase, and that works well, and it makes people think, okay, we got to get behind this. But the whole development of the Common Core was a marketing strategy to market testing.
Yeah, but I listened to the video that Bill Gates put out, and he says the Common Core is not a curriculum. It's an idea.
Yeah, I know, and that's where he's gone back to now too. But I tell people to take a Google, go back Bill Gates' early comments on the Common Core, and he will tell you the standards lead to the curriculum, which create tests. The tests are what's then used to see if we're measuring, and then it's just a complete circle that continues going round and round and round. It's a beautiful, you know, it's a marketing strategy, as people have pointed out. And these are his words, and he said this. And for anybody who says that it's just an idea, that's fine. Then show me a place where they're using the Common Core and they are not tied to either the park or the smarter balance assessments. There is not a single place that exists where the Common Core can actually survive as just supposed standards where they can talk about what teachers might want to do with kids. No, every place that they are being used, they are also being, you know, federally mandated that they be tested by either PARC or smarter balance assessments. So it's ridiculous that it's just a powerful idea. It's not a powerful idea. It's a marketing strategy to sell schools something else they don't need at the expense of, Rick. And this is the other thing. People have to understand the amount of money that's about to be spent on standards and tests, which over the past 30 years, we've spent a lot of money on standards and tests and have found out that they actually do nothing to actually help the achievement gap, students that are struggling. We're about to spend even more money than ever on standards and tests when we know that what we need to spend money on, as Stephen Krashen from UCLA points out, we need to spend money on just minimal health care, minimal nutrition, and access to books. If you spent the money, half the money you're about to spend on testing, on those three things, you would accomplish so much more with the achievement gap.
Yeah, by trying to do something to alleviate poverty in those areas that where it's extraordinarily high, where the quote unquote failing schools seem to be found.
Right, and that's it. You know, I was talking to somebody around here who says, you know, show me a distressed community and show me a distressed school, and vice versa. Whichever one you have, they're both there. They're coexisting. Why? It has nothing to do with the fact that the school itself is causing a distressed community. It's the fact that the distress, the poverty, the trauma that the community is under it reflects itself in the school population. And whether you're using test scores or whether you're using artwork, you're going to see that trauma in the students come out and expressed in that. What we see now in measurement for achievement is that we show a major gap between what really shows to be poor minority students and, you know, white suburban students. Why the gap? The gap has absolutely nothing to do with standards and has absolutely nothing to do with tests. The gap has everything to do with the opportunities we don't provide students that are living in socioeconomic conditions that are horrible and, you know, and they're poor minority. They're the black and brown children in the cities. We just don't want to admit that for some reason.
Yeah, and, you know, I look at this and you bring up the tests. And here in my school district anyway, and I think across the Commonwealth, next Monday will begin the testing season, which I guess it's like football, basketball. We now have testing season.
Well, it's March Madness.
And it is madness.
Right.
And I look at this, and my daughter, who last year, you know, I talked to you about this last year, you know, she was play teaching with her brother and sister, saying, you know, if you don't pass this test, they're going to take money from the school and close everything down, and we'll be all standing out here in the field going, what do we do? Because that's what she was told. And at the beginning of this year, we went to parent-teacher conference, and the teacher assured me, oh, you have nothing to worry about, Mr. Smith. Your daughter's going to pass the PSSA.
Right. Well,
that's not what I want.
Well, hey, thank goodness. You know, I mean, there's something that you can talk about later in life. And actually, I talk to parents, you know, who say, but doesn't it matter that my kid scores, you know, proficient and that they get good things back? Isn't this going to go, you know, a quote as we've all been told, you know, on our permanent record? And the answer is no. It has nothing to do with the child's permanent record. It has nothing to do with placement. I was just actually talking to a parent again tonight in opt-out who of course was erroneously told that if their child doesn't pass the third grade PSSA, they won't go to fourth grade. There is absolutely nothing further from the truth. The PSSA linked to moving up in grades, not even it's not even there. That's a threat. That's a scare tactic to try to get parents not to opt out. There is no connection. There's no permanent record. And if your child scores, you know, genius, or if your child scores below genius, it has nothing to do, because it's a ranking system. And this is the other thing for people in Pennsylvania need to recognize. It's a ranking system that will be out of date and out of circulation as of next year anyway. So the whole idea that anybody is putting any weight at all in the PSSA is absolutely ridiculous. And in fact, if any parent, if you want to do something, just keep your, you know, opt out for now, because it's a worthless test. It's meaningless. And Pennsylvania is about to enter where it has the waiver state, and start gearing up for what's going to be coming next year, because next year the Common Core assessments they're going to sweep Pennsylvania is what's going to be the biggest thing you're going to need to opt out. But opt out now. PSSAs, they're worthless. They're not going to go in your permanent record. They're not going to show up when you go for your first job interview. They're not going to hold you back from graduating from, you know, Harvard or Yale when somebody finds out that you had a mediocre PSSA score. They're worthless marketing tools that are used to take money from taxpayers that should be used to buy biology lab equipment, to buy books, or to buy health care and nutrition for students that need it.
Yeah, I mean, all of those things I think would be much better than a bubble test. And I've talked to some parents who have told their kids, ah, don't worry about it. You know, do what you can. Whatever. And I'm going, well, why not, if that's the mentality, why not opt out and say, we're going to take the numbers away from you that you're using to destroy our school with?
Right. Right, and that's what we've been talking about from United Opt Out, is that, remember, this is all about data, and in fact, I talked about this the other night with another parent. You know, if you recognize that this is really not about your child, but this is about your child providing data to a system that is designed to use that data to prove that your school is failing, then why would you ever participate in it? Because it's a system set up to actually use your child as a provider of data that is guaranteed to show that your school is failing, and guaranteed to set in motion a failing public school narrative, guaranteed to set in motion, you know, failing public schools, and then doing what Diane says, creating the ability for some hedge fund manager to own a charter school in the name of your own public school.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but it was supposed to be 2014 that 100% of the kids who took these tests were supposed to be proficient, or they would
right.
be labeled failing. Now, I think they've walked back from that, but even the thought that you would even propose that 100% of the kids pass this test seems to me to be, well, fairyland.
Well, it's fairyland. It's unrealistic, and again, But when you start to say, okay, it's fairyland, it's unrealistic, it's a good goal, though. People will say something like that to me. Say, no, it's not a good goal, because actually we have measures in place that are holding us to that standard. So therefore, that sets in motion the guaranteed failure of your public education system, because you can't meet an unrealistic goal such as 100% proficiency. This, though, again, trying to explain this to people now, this isn't going away when PSSAs go away. When Common Core and the new PARC assessments and the Smarter Balance assessments take over, we're again put on a track for failure, because, again, the bar is set higher than it's ever been, and it expects 100% of the students to achieve that bar. We're still going to set it. So we're replacing a system that guarantees failure with another system that guarantees failure.
And the other part of it is, as I understand it, and again, you're the guy who knows this stuff, as I understand, they're tying these tests then to teacher evaluations here in Pennsylvania, which, again, in my view, is about making the teaching profession unstable so that then you can then push towards more privatization.
Well, it has tons of different effects, and none of them are positive. I mean, you imagine, I talk to parents and say, you know, parents will say, well, I really want to make sure that my teacher is teaching my child, and this is a good way to ensure it. And I said, no, this is a good way to ensure that your child's teacher is absolutely teaching stuff that's irrelevant and only stuff that's on the test, and therefore stuff that's meaningful, art, music, literature, science, history, all the stuff that matters is not going to be taught. So when you say to teachers, we're going to measure you based on your kids' Common Core test scores, you are guaranteeing that your kids are not going to be taught a fully, full, deep, rich curriculum. In fact, it is the And I this is the other ask people, the most exclusive private schools in Pennsylvania, guess what they're not doing? Holding teachers accountable to the Common Core test. In fact, they're not using the Common Core, and they're not holding their teachers accountable to tests. Why? Because they know that's detrimental to the learning environment.
Yeah, I mean, you look at the places where the president would send his kids, or Rahm Emanuel in Chicago, or some
right.
of the other well-to-do people. They're not drilling and bubbling and all of this stuff. And they don't have my daughter in sixth grade sits in LGI. You know what LGI stands for?
Large group instruction, man.
Well, all right. There's no punchline there for me. But
sorry.
100 kids in a sixth grade class. I'm going, what?
Right.
I had university courses that weren't 100 people in it.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, good teachers can teach more students, Rick. I mean, that's the whole, idea.
But 100?
No, actually, I think that's absolutely nonsense. In fact, that's part of the reformers' discussion is that, you know, if you get one good teacher, well, then you can get rid of two crappy teachers because one good teacher could then take up the slack. And there's nothing further from the truth. Anytime you move more and more students into a classroom, you're creating the inability for a teacher to be truly effective. And so large group instruction, it has its place in certain times. However, if it's being done because we're saying that this teacher is some phenomenal best teacher, well, if you're giving them 100 students, you're actually making sure then that teacher can't be their best because no teacher can be their best teaching 100 students.
Not in the sixth grade. I don't care.
Not in the sixth grade, right. Not in the sixth grade. And you know what? Look back to your days in college. It wasn't even that great when you were in college either.
No, I had classes mostly in college were between 50 and 75.
Right. And, you know, and I look back at those and people say, well, they did it then. I said, yeah, you know, again, there were a lot of things people did back then, back when. And there's a lot of that stuff that we don't do anymore because we found out that it's silly, it's racist, it's painful, it's bigoted. You know, so why education can't change? And that's part of the problem, right? Everybody says this is, well, this is the way I was taught, you know, and this is the way, or back in the day where, you know, things aren't that great back in the day. So anybody who likes to use that, that drives me crazy. But think about some of the reforms that we're putting in place. We're actually moving in that direction where we're saying, you know what, we don't want creative teaching. We don't want deep, rich learning. We want kids bubbling in tests. We want to predict where their scores are. We want to be able to go out as a newly minted politician. I want to make sure that I can claim that my district has high test scores and they're a result of me being a legislator who holds teachers accountable. And there's absolutely, if there's a politician running around getting elected on that, I would tell you, the listeners for your show to make sure that they understand that that politician is making sure that your kid gets the absolute worst education. Right, raising test scores is an indication that everything's going wrong in your school.
Wow, I've never heard anyone put it that way. So why is that then?
Well, because I can teach kids to. I can do this. I can teach kids to increase their test scores without actually teaching them what they need to know. And that's what parents need to understand is that raising test scores requires drill and kill. And I can get just about any group of non-brain damaged, and I don't mean that in a silly way. I mean that truthfully. You give me a group of students who don't have any brain dysfunctions, and I can train them to increase their test scores, and yet I can come back and guarantee you that they know nothing more than they did before they took the test.
Wow. So let's go back to this test and kind of wrap this up because, you know, a lot of folks are like me at the beginning going, well, you know, they use tests for, you know, assessment and, you know, if they don't have this information, they're not going to know what's wrong. Then I find out the tests, we don't actually get the answers for months. And, you know, in an era where we think everything is instant, we want instant this or instant that, it's amazing to me that the results of these tests, we don't get back for months.
No, you know, I mean, teachers don't get them back until the following October, which again, for anybody who, so remember, if you're going to be held back, What are they going to do? Come in October in fifth grade and say, "Look, we got your PSSAs back. We're going to have to move you back to fourth grade." So again, that doesn't happen, and again, that's silly. And in fact, though, you know, thinking about testing, though, Rick, I mean, make this clear for anybody who says that, you know, Slecker and these people that you're talking to are just anti-testing. I'm sitting there telling you no, as my friend Jesse Agopian in Seattle would say, you know, teachers invented tests. We love tests. In fact, you know, I give tests all the time. The tests I give, though, are relevant. They're put together by me, and they are about the things that I'm teaching. Therefore, I love assessment. I love tests. Without them, I don't know what I'm doing in a classroom. So this is not about a no-testing movement. This is about using authentic assessment with kids so that we can authentically, as you say, help them understand where they are, help them move ahead, help them achieve the things that they're supposed to achieve. Bubble tests don't do that.
Yeah, and that's what I've explained to my daughter, because she will not be taking them. And she's like, yeah, I don't have to take tests. I go, no. You don't have to take this test. You
right.
still have to take a bunch of others. And, in fact, what I'm trying to get her teachers to do is to give her some other tests so that they can say, hey, this is what we're working on in class. Let's see if at least you know that.
Right. And you know, I don't know what kind of time you're up, but quickly, a study from last week or 2 weeks ago, ACT, SAT, and grades in high school. Grades in high school came out, again, unequivocally as the best predictor of college success. Okay? And we've been told time and time again that teachers' grades are too subjective. They vary from school to school. We don't know if they really mean the same thing. Well, large, massive studies, massive data set, SAT, ACT scores, and high school grades predict way, you know, success in college can be attributed to understanding a kid's grades well more above the SAT and the ACT. So, again, bubble tests don't give us the information we want. Bubble tests provide information to allow policymakers, to allow pundits to make broad proclamations of either some type of success that they think they're due, or some failure that they're going to remedy. That's all that's going on there.
Yeah. Last question. If you had kids in these grades, would you subject them to them?
No, I don't. In fact, you know, my son's in eighth grade, my son's in fifth grade, or my daughter's in fifth grade, and this is year five of me taking them out of tests. So, absolutely not. Any test that is used to sort my kid into some misappropriate, any test used to rank my kid, to rank their teacher, to rank their school, my kids don't take those tests. Any test that a teacher puts together for my son, that a teacher puts together for my daughter, they're taking that test absolutely. But any of these tests that are used to declare my kids' teachers in schools failure, they will never take that test.
All right. Good. Tim, I appreciate you talking to us. I appreciate the information, and I look forward to hearing from you again.
All right, Rick. Thanks, man. It was great talking to you, too.
Always great, Tim Slecker. You can check some of what Tim's got to say on his blog talk radio program at The Chalk Face. At thechalkface.com, the website. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. United Opt Out, also a good place for some information. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no. They're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by Ask Me Council 13.
Standing up to conservatives and corporatists every weeknight, The Rick Smith Show.
So now you see the light. Hey, stand up for your rights. Come on,
get up. Get up.
Yeah, I'm going to have to use that. I'm going to have to use that line. You know, if it's a test to rate my kid's teacher or the school, I'm not going to take it. If it's a test to find out what the kid, what my daughter knows or my son knows, you're absolutely taking it. That's been my view on it. And, you know, look, I've had a couple of folks say, well, you know, you're just trying to upset the apple cart. Yeah, this is an apple cart that's designed to run us over. And, you know, we've been talking about No Child Left Behind, the Common Core, all of these things for years. And it appeared to me from the beginning that the whole point of this was to destroy our local public schools and move to a privatized model. And I think, as Diane Ravitch so eloquently pointed out, you know, why is it we want to give people a charter school to go with their yacht? I mean, really, you know, Bill Gates is a mastermind when it comes to the software and all that. I don't know that you're going to pull that over into education. I think you let the professionals do that. And people who are well-tested, well-trained, and it's their craft. And to me, this whole push, this whole testing regime is all about destroying that craft. Because, man, haven't we been told for a long time, well, you know, it's those lazy teachers. It's those bad teachers. How many times have we heard that? They're bad teachers. I gotta tell you, I've never actually had a bad teacher. I had some evil nuns. I had some nuns that would take the stick out, the bakery board out. It's probably unfair, isn't it? But, you know, here's the reality. I got beat an awful lot, so I do have some grounds. But, you know, for me, the bottom line in this is very simple. I'm not going to play into a system where it's designed to rank and to do all of the things that we were talking about and put my kid in a situation where, you know, now she's just inundated with, not only am I not going to do well, but my school and the district and all of humanity is not going to do well. I'm sorry, just not buying it. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast, Stitcher on the smartphone. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. 13,000 patient healthcare workers at the University of California could be on strike March 24th. The workers took a strike vote, and 97% of them approved a 5-day strike to start March 24th. AFSCME Local 3299 says the strike is an unfair labor practices strike triggered by UC's imposing contract terms that includes healthcare benefit cuts. The union also takes exception to an emergency layoff clause in UC's contract proposal. AFSCME calls that a poison pill. The workers want to reach a fair negotiated contract settlement with UC, and AFSCME is calling on the university to stop unfair labor practices. AFSCME 3299 was able to reach an agreement with UC for thousands of service workers back in February, averting a 5-day strike that had been planned then. If these patient care is a big potential safety problem that can't be ignored.
We're seeing a trend where more and more freight is being moved with less people, and any way you take away people from the right-of-ways of the American railroads, you are losing hands-on inspections of moving trains, of track. Mechanical and track inspections are absolutely essential to the interest of public safety. We want to guard against needless alarmism. However, we want to encourage that all parties move with urgency to protect public safety.
New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio is trying to figure out how to make good on back pay for the city's teachers union without creating financial problems for the city. The teachers have been working without a contract for 4.5 years. The union is seeking a new labor contract and will want to make up the back pay. The city is having trouble coming up with the $3.4 billion that it will cost for 2 of the years teachers have been working without a contract. Mayor de Blasio is proposing a 9-year contract deal
to stretch the back wage payments over a longer time period. A deal with teachers is just part of the picture. Mayor de Blasio is also working on a comprehensive approach to negotiating deals with all of New York City's labor unions, who were unable to reach agreements with former Mayor Michael Bloomberg.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
The Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from the Bank of Labor, a division of Brotherhood Bank and Trust, member FDIC, equal
Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
Somebody's watching.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So on Friday, the Commerce Department announced that it planned to give up its oversight of the Internet Corporation for assigned names and numbers, this group called ICANN. And, you know, I saw reports all over. Fox News went crazy. I got to be honest, I'm a little uncomfortable with giving who knows where it goes. But knowing that I don't know all that there is to know here, there's part of me that goes, I'm a little leery. Anytime we start to privatize and push stuff off, I don't know how it works out well for people like you and me. But I did decide that I needed to get a little more information, which is why we've asked Stephen Kramer. He is a computer network. So we're going to give up the control of the names and the addresses and all this stuff. I guess first question is, what does that mean?
Well, ICANN itself has been around for quite a long time. Like you said, it's an internet corporation. It's based in California. And it's always been the organization that has taken care of basically the administrative details of the internet. So, in other words, the assignment of domain names, IP addresses, but IP being internet protocol in this case. Now, in many cases, you're going to... And they operate what is called the root servers for name service. Essentially, what the way that names are translated on the internet is that you have an authority of some kind. And everybody, when they get a name on the internet, your computer is going to go ahead and try to look that thing up, try to figure out who it belongs to. The root servers for this authority have been operated by ICANN. And ICANN has had a relationship through a compact with the Department of Commerce, basically as sort of a holdover from when the net first got started. It really began, the internet itself, as something called the ARPANET, which is Advanced Research Projects Agency, which was in turn something that was created by DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. So it is not too much of an exaggeration to say that really the entire internet has been sort of a Defense Department project gone berserk.
Sure.
And,
I mean, like most inventions, like most things in our country that we've invested in, it's got military roots.
Absolutely. And this is, you know, when we started this back in the 80s and really into the 70s, that was how you got the funding, was you went ahead and tied it to something that was with the defense agency. Something like, you know, in other words, being able to say, well, we're creating a computer network out there, but it's resistant to, for example, things like enemy attack. And they even went ahead and included things like nuclear attack. And that is the reason that the internet has sort of a decentralized structure in the first place.
So let's say we do give this control up. What happens to ICANN? And what happens to what will we notice anything different, or don't we know?
Well, really, we're not going to notice a heck of a lot that's different. The international agencies that have been involved with some of internet engineering, like the Internet Engineering Task Force, have been pushing for this for many years. I mean, just because it's, you know, basically this has been a remnant that has stuck around since the days of ARPANET. So they really wanted to go to a more internationalized authority. The suggestion at that point was the United Nations, what it's been doing to...
With some not friendly aims, somehow able to take it over. I hate to sound conspiratorial, but you wonder down the road. I mean, I'm not thrilled with how things have with the NSA and with the Snowden stuff has played out, but I worry about what happens down the road.
Well, sure, and I think a lot of things have gotten sort of spun around because of the nature of, you know, what it means to, quote-unquote, control the Internet. What ICANN is doing and what IANA, the Internet Assigned Numbers Authority, that it sort of absorbed, were doing, was a lot of sort of the very basic engineering aspects of this thing. It's not the sort of thing that anybody who is going to go ahead and type an address into a browser is ever going to see. As a matter of fact, that's basically the idea, is to keep it as simple as it can be for the end user. Really, with the idea of the root servers going into a more internationalized grid, for example, there's less of a chance of having one country go ahead and control the entire thing, which is roughly the way it's happening right now. If we have a root server that's in the United States, one in the UK, one in Canada, one in Germany, what we have, because of that decentralized nature of the net that I mentioned before, is a number of choices that we can go to. And these things will go ahead and operate on best practices for engineering. Right, what the other thing that countries are concerned about right now is we're all going to the United States to try to get our basic information.
And I guess I could see how if you were somewhere else, you wouldn't be all that thrilled with it. But now then that you're going to open this up, now aren't you opening it up to more maybe cyber terrorism, more cyber crimes, more things on that line?
Well, because of that, again, the nature of the Internet that I mentioned before, a lot of this is a redundant and resilient in its infrastructure. And by that, I mean that all of these base machines that control information on the Internet are going to go ahead and check with each other in order to go ahead and make sure that they have the right information. And if there's a problem with something like, let's say, a cyber terrorism attack where you take out one of these machines, traffic is going to get routed around that and go to, in that case, even another country. So it really does make it actually a little bit more resilient, because if you have a situation where, for example, we have a terrorist attack in Northern Virginia where a lot of these computers reside, that's going to take out a great number of them at once. In this case, you might have, you know, traffic going ahead and rerouting to a Germany or Canada, something like that, something where it would be a lot harder to go ahead and take out all of the targets at once.
So with that in mind, because, you know, I'm starting to run this through a little bit, you know, maybe a little differently, then maybe, because one of my big concerns, especially with the Internet, is you look at the recent Verizon case by the Supreme Court that I'm sure you could speak much more in depth about than I can. But this idea that they're going to be able to throttle speeds and do all kinds of different things to promote certain content over others. Would this have anything to affect that? I mean, would you be able to go elsewhere to bypass that? How would that work?
Not exactly. What we're dealing with right now is sort of a different kettle of fish. That's something called net neutrality.
Right.
And that is going to affect the actual access and speeds that customers will have on the Internet. What we're looking at with something like ICANN is going to be some of the base information that, for example, when you type it into a particular browser, it's going to go and say, okay, Google is actually this address, and it's going to route you in the correct direction. It's sort of a matter of basically who controls the roads compared to who controls the signs on the road, for example.
Yeah, that makes sense. So is there anything to be upset about with this? I mean, because it seemed to get a lot of play. I mean, you've got the business community not all that thrilled. In fact, the Wall Street Journal reported that, that U.S. businesses are what they put nervous because they don't know what to expect. So any here then?
Well, I think the main concern about a lot of the American interest, and particularly the American corporate interest, is not quite the ICANN decision, but what prompted the ICANN decision. And again, that was a lot of the problems that were brought up through Edward Snowden's revelations about the NSA. Right now, American information technology businesses have taken a tremendous hit overseas. It's hard to overestimate how much damage has been done. And this is not because of ICANN, but it's because of the NSA, because we've got a lot of countries now who are issuing proclamations basically saying American technology cannot be trusted. And this is basically just another hit that they're taking in order to, you know, and it basically it feels like some of that control that was centralized in the United States is starting to slip away from us.
So what this is, in essence, then, is us going, well, you can trust us because we're going to let it go.
Right, exactly. And, you know, and a number of countries, like I said, particularly in Germany, because that seems to be the main beneficiary of a lot of the technology impetus that's going on right now, are basically saying there's no way you can trust the United States, not with the root servers, not with their technology, you know, not with their encryption. There's a whole lot of questions, basic questions that have been brought up because of what has been revealed.
Yeah, I got to be honest. I got a whole bunch of questions as well about, you know, who's been seeing what and all of the NSA stuff. Because, you know, it used to be that, you know, our government couldn't hold on to all of this information. Seems like they are. I mean, it used to be there would be that those private companies would hold it and we would just buy it. Now it seems not even that layer.
Absolutely. You know, this was something that I actually saw in, you know, when I was researching some of the encryption techniques and things of that nature over the last 5 to 10 years. And what I was seeing was that for a lot of the intelligence community entities, and a lot of them around here, I live here in central Maryland, a lot of these guys have had this capability for quite a while. The question was, how are they going to store it, and how are they going to parse it? Parse in this case being, you know, sift through it to find the information that they really need. And what they seem to have made the decision to do over the last couple of years, and this is what has been revealed, is we're just simply going to siphon up every single bit of it. And there have been deals with American companies, with, you know, Google, Verizon, things of that nature. And they, I mean, a lot of cases have some kind of unspecified backdoors, which we're still seeing some information come out about right now.
Yeah, I mean, I remember, you know, years ago saying, if you don't think that every stroke you make on the computer, someone can find every email you send, every we were doing the instant messaging, every instant message, text, all of that. Because back then I was going, you know, somebody's got to be looking at this stuff. It's just not going out into nowhere. And now we find out that a lot of that was true. And I got to wonder, you know, these things we carry around in our pocket, you know, since you brought up back doors, how often do you think they can turn these things on and just, oh, let's see where you're at and what you're talking about?
In a great many cases, I would, you know, before I would have said that it would have been very difficult because of the legal ramifications. At this point, I don't think they're really paying attention to that many legal ramifications. I think it's entirely possible that they are going to need to, you know, if they discover a need for all of this, or even if they don't, they're just going to siphon up all of the information and see if they can use it later.
Yeah, I mean, thanks to the Patriot Act, and you know, it's amazing how you go back to September 11th, 2001, and some of the predictions of that this was the end of our democracy have come true.
Absolutely. You know, if you take a look especially at what was supposed to be the safeguards to keep all of that happening, for example, the so-called FISA court, the one that would go ahead and regulate a lot of these demands and a lot of the subpoenas that were being made by the intelligence community. Well, it turned out that they were basically a rubber stamp. And even after that, very few cases that they actually went ahead and objected to and sent back to the intelligence community, the intelligence community simply did it anyway.
Yeah. Well, didn't they have a retroactive system where you'd go, you'd do whatever you wanted, and then you had like 15 days to go before the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court?
Yeah, that's right. And even at that, there were, when I'm talking about a very few cases, I'm talking much less than 1%. Of these cases where they actually went ahead and raised any kind of problems with them. Even the ones where they went ahead and we're talking about the initial act with Verizon, I believe was that particular one where they just simply went ahead and subpoenaed every single record that Verizon had.
That's just amazing. And again, I guess it comes down to the, you know, again, you go back to the Patriot Act and all of that, the power that we gave without anybody really reading the bill or without any. And I remember going back to that period, I had gone to the League of Women Voters had done a panel of three experts who were for it, three experts who were against it. And oddly enough, the three people who actually read the entire Patriot Act, they were the ones who were against it. The ones who read the Cliff Notes, they were for it.
Oh, yeah. And there was, you know, one particular senator at the time, a fellow from Wisconsin by the name of Russ Feingold. He was the one, I believe he might have been the lone dissenting vote against the Patriot Act. And his office was one of the ones that had gone ahead and parsed through the entire thing and had figured out all of the ramifications thereof behind it. And he tried to warn us, and unfortunately, because of the rush to pass something of that nature after 9/11, it was not repeated.
I just want to feel safe, Steve. Just want to feel safe, whatever.
I tell you, if people want to feel safe, I tell them to use very strong encryption on their email and on their communications, because that's the one thing that's going to keep us safe from not only the so-called bad guys out there, but also the people from our own government.
Yeah, but here's the thing. What if you're a technological idiot like I am who struggles to even read my email, let alone know what strong encryption actually looks like?
Right. Well, there's a couple of very good ones out there. You know, oddly enough, what I tell people to do is when they find out some of these revelations behind, the NSA, there are a couple of times when the NSA sent around internal emails and such like that, complaining that they couldn't crack something. And I say, that's the one you want to use.
There you go. But I'm also of the mindset that I want them reading my emails. Maybe they'll learn something.
I've had a friend of mine who went ahead and did exactly that. He would say, I'm going to encrypt everything, even if it's just about, you know, me going ahead and going, you know, asking a friend of mine to go skiing with me, just so they'll have something to read.
Yeah. It's amazing, amazing stuff. So last question on this, then. This getting rid of this ICANN or globalizing it, I guess. In your opinion, not a big deal, good thing, bad thing, just to wrap it up?
Again, I would say basically a good thing and not too big of a deal. Again, this is something that international engineering authorities have been asking for quite a while. And, you know, the idea of, you know, dealing with the realities of a global internet, it really should have a global governance behind it and global standards that it is based on.
Yeah, and there's part of me still goes, you know, we created it. It should be ours. Just because on some level, your nationalistic level, because I don't want somebody from Germany telling me, no, you can't do this.
Right. It's always going to be that kind of thing. Basically, even if you go on to foreign websites, the language they speak is going to be English. People recognize that most of the traffic is still going to go through the United States. Most of the control in terms of the software that's used is still going to be coming from the United States. But this is just going to be something that gives the global community a little something to hang their hat on, I think.
There you go. All right. Well, I appreciate you explaining it to us, Steve. When it comes to this kind of stuff, I'm well out of my league. So it's good to have someone who explains it on my level, and I appreciate that.
No problem at all, Rick.
Thanks so much, Steve Kramer. Let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people from the talk.
Controversial, thought-provoking, opinionated. Rick Smith.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no. They're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
Tenacity can be a virtue, but the persistent push by giant food conglomerates to deceive us consumers has turned their tenacity into raw mendacity.
Brand name food peddlers are spending hundreds of millions of dollars on lobbyists, lawyers, campaign donations, PR hypesters, and political manipulators so they can genetically and dangerously alter the dinner we put on our family tables without bothering to tell us which items they've messed with. With practically no public notice, their first deception was to get Washington to okay the production and introduction of genetically modified organisms into corn, canola, soy, and other crops. Then, they quietly pushed to prevent federal regulators from requiring that these tampered Frankenfoods be labeled as containing GMOs. Next, they tried a grand deception, insisting that foods tainted with GMOs qualify for the national organic label. Even our usually submissive regulators balked at that one. But look out, for here they come again. Big Foods Industry Front Group, the Grocery Manufacturers Association, is now demanding that foods with genetically engineered ingredients be allowed to use the word natural on their packages. Natural? Let's see. One, these biotech mutations are not products of nature, but of corporate technicians. And two, the plants are manufactured in corporate labs by extracting genes from a foreign plant or even an animal, then splicing those genes into the manufactured creature. The very DNA of this man-made food is altered, with no understanding of the long-term environmental or health consequences. This is Jim Hightower saying, a Twinkie is more natural than that. They're perverting both our language and nature's reality. To oppose these profiteers' tenacious mendaciousness, contact the Environmental Working Group. That's at www.ewg.org.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
So have you been following this this Malaysian plane disappearing? Have you been following what's going on with this? I mean, every time there seems to be a different twist, a different turn. This Malaysian airline flight MH370, which at this point, the latest that I've come across is, and I don't think they're saying that it was hijacked by these 20, but kind of just throwing it out that, well, you never know. And again, I love how this just keeps piling up. But the headline read, Malaysian plane, 20 on board worked for electronic warfare and military radar firm. Evidently this company that their gig, this company called Freescale Semiconductor, they make microchips for the defense industry. And they evidently just, you know, the beginning of March had released a really new hyper, you know, super powerful product onto the market. And then 5 days later, 20 of their people are on this plane. 12 of them were of Malaysian descent, and 8 of them were Chinese nationals. And you go back and understand, look, Malaysia did a really smart thing, you know, about 20 years ago, where they trained tons of engineers and tons of computer engineers and computer specialists, because that was their gig. They were going to be the computer hub of the world and do all of that work that was being outsourced from the U.S. They were your cheap alternative, and they're very good at it as well. But you've got this American company, this Freescale Semiconductor, who, you know, had 20 people on this plane, and the article points out, it's a Guardian article, points out that the shareholders of this Freescale Semiconductor, people who have big money in the Carlyle Group. You may remember the Carlyle Group there, George H.W. Bush's group that they big, huge defense money. Also former Prime Minister of Britain, John Major, one of their big advisors to this Carlyle Group. And you may remember hearing a lot about, you know, all of the warp going on part of this as well. So is it one have anything to do with the other? Was it just bad, you know, for the company, lost all this technical know-how? Or was it somehow, were they involved? I don't know, you know, and it's just getting weirder and weirder as the days go on, because, you know, you thought from the Chinese satellites images that, you know, they thought they found where the wreckage may have been. They didn't. Still looking. There's a bunch of different things going on. It's just kind of, you know, in this day and age, with all of the technology, all of the radar, all of the satellites, all the sophistication, and supposedly these big jumbo jets with all of this, these beacons and buzzers and bells and whistles and whatnot and widgets, we should be able to find this damn thing, right? You would think. So I wonder how long it's going to take or whatever happened to it. And will we know, or is this going to be another thing where, you know, for the next couple of months it's going to be, wow, we found something else out as we scour through these people, these 239 people's lives. And at some point you're going to, is everyone now a suspect in this? Yeah, maybe, you know. Anyway, interesting story. So, you know, it makes me think, though, you know, do you want to fly anymore? I mean, me, I'm not a big fan of flying. But in this day and age, you never know. It's there was some talk that they had something on the plane, if you remember, and I forget the name of the airline. I think it was Value Jet, if I remember right. That, you know, send it up in the air and had explode, boom, gone. Anyway, let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Not right wing. Just right. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. 13,000 patient healthcare workers at the University of California could be on strike March 24th. The workers took a strike vote, and 97% of them approved a five-day strike to start March 24th. AFSCME Local 3299 says the strike is an unfair labor practices strike triggered by UC's imposing contract terms that includes healthcare benefit cuts. The union also takes exception to an emergency layoff clause in UC's contract proposal. AFSCME calls that a poison pill. The workers want to reach a fair negotiated contract settlement with UC, and AFSCME is calling on the university to stop unfair labor practices. AFSCME 3299 was able to reach an agreement with UC for thousands of service workers back in February, averting a five-day strike that had been planned then. If these patient care workers strike for 5 days now, it could cost UC as much as $50 million, according to the university. A major restructuring of the Canadian Pacific Railway could cut as many as 4,500 jobs. Phil Qualley of Minnesota's United Transportation Union says that poses a big potential safety problem that can't be ignored.
We're seeing a trend where more and more freight is being moved with less people, and any way you take away people from the right-of-ways of the American railroads, you are losing hands-on inspections of moving trains, of track. Mechanical and track inspections are absolutely essential to the interest of public safety. We want to guard against needless alarmism. However, we want to encourage that all parties move with urgency to protect public safety.
New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio is trying to figure out how to make good on back pay for the city's teachers union without creating financial problems for the city. The teachers have been working without a contract for 4.5 years. The union is seeking a new labor contract and will want to make up the back pay. The city is having trouble coming up with the $3.4 billion that it will cost for 2 of the years teachers have been working without a contract. Mayor de Blasio is proposing a 9-year contract deal to stretch the back wage payments over a longer time period. A deal with teachers is just part of the picture. Mayor de Blasio is also working on a comprehensive approach to negotiating deals with all of New York City's labor unions who were unable to reach agreements with former Mayor Michael Bloomberg.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day.
To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
The Workers' Independent News is brought to you with support from the Bank of Labor, a division of Brotherhood Bank and Trust, member FDIC, equal opportunity lender. Union-owned, union-represented Bank of Labor offers a business Visa card with no annual fee and points earned with every purchase, along with rental vehicle and travel accident insurance. Online at bankoflabor.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com, or tweet me at the Rick Smith Show, or Facebook, you know, all of that. Anyway, you can get a hold of me, there they are. Or just go to the website, thericksmithshow.com. It's all right there for your ease, convenience, entertainment, enjoyment, all of those things. Also, a little bit of news. And speaking of news, let's find out what's going on in Washington, D.C. Our good friend Bob Ney, Talk Radio News Service. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you, Rick.
So I see that the... A little earlier we were talking about the changes that are coming to the Internet. I'm curious what the news from D.C. is.
I think for the average person, it surprises them that there's a nonprofit. It's called ICANN, I-C-A-N-N, and that stands for the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, or ICANN. And it's a nonprofit group out of Los Angeles that actually controls, which we can say, web domain names and other aspects of Internet architecture. And it operates under a contract with the Department of Commerce. The Obama administration is telling Commerce to communicate to ICANN, this nonprofit group, that they should have a little bit more global and involve multiple stakeholders, which means, you know, foreign countries and other entities on a global basis. Now, everybody kind of yawned on this, but all of a sudden now people are saying, well, wait a minute now, better get to some more details, because do you want these days a Russia and a China sitting on some board, and they will cleverly, you know, privatize this thing and then buy it and then control domain names, you know, a lot of money in that thing. So,
well, no, I look at it, this is the first move towards privatizing it. Who's to say it's going to be Russia or China? Could be any one of our billionaires. Google, for instance. I'm not worried so much about countries anymore. I'm worried about these huge multinational corporations who could care less about countries.
Yeah, or the Koch brothers or anybody.
Because, you know, whoever owns this stuff, man, could lots of power.
I never thought about that. You make a great point because, you know, I was thinking about foreign countries, you know. Now, based on what you said, does stir my mind up here, though. Mary Kissel of the Wall Street Editorial Board, Wall Street Journal, she says, I don't normally defend them a lot, meaning Obama, but on this one, I will. So Wall Street's already... You make a very good point. Wall Street's already saying, nah, this is not a bad idea.
And I generally have a rule. Anything that the Wall Street Journal is in favor of, I generally take the opposite position because I don't know how it can be good for me. I understand how the newspaper of the investor class, that used to be their tagline, right? I don't know if they use that anymore.
Exactly. No, they don't. I don't believe.
But it used to be the newspaper of the investor class. Whenever the newspaper of the investor class says there's an idea, it's not for the working class. It's for the investor class. That's their audience, right?
Correct.
Yeah, I mean, I worry about all that stuff because, and you know, then you combine that with our Supreme Court decision on the Comcast thing and Verizon, and you see all of this consolidation of media. We're going to see Comcast growing bigger, bigger, and bigger. Verizon now, if I understand this case right, can then dictate who gets faster speeds based on who can pay.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
I mean, all of this stuff does not lead towards a democratic outcome. I fear small D democracy is going to get even smaller.
But again, the whole fear is in foreign countries. But you make a good point. Combined with what the Wall Street Journal said, you know, could make it pretty hairy about how much you're going to pay and who's going to control the internet.
Although, truth of the matter, corporate America has already destroyed my internet. I live basically in the Siberia of internet, which is here just outside of Carlisle. I've upload speeds of just around 5 gigabytes up, and less than one, or 5 gigabytes down, less than 1 gigabyte up.
Well, if you look at the history of corporate America, just look at the electric companies. That's why rural electric cooperatives were formed. Electric companies couldn't make money, so they wouldn't take it any further.
Yeah, but they're making tons of money off of me, Bob. That's the thing that irks me. I don't mind paying for a good product, but I'm getting junk, man. Getting junk. All right, so I see Obamacare hit 5 million already. That's quicker than I thought.
It is. I actually am surprised, too. I really didn't think it would hit 5 million by this time. Of course, the goal is, budget office projected 7 million. But they're getting there. And, of course, they have some time yet. And then stuff will still continue to trickle in after that, too. I mean, it's a March 31st deadline, but still there's people that will sign up after that. They're not going to be taken to court for not signing up.
Yeah. Well, I mean, any of these things, I mean, you're going to have a process. There's going to be a, with all of the money, I mean, I got to be honest, $5 million seems like a huge number to me. With all of the money, all of the special interests saying, no, don't do it, and all of the Tea Party types going, show your protest and deny yourself health care. $5 million is a good number for me.
At first, I think it was all the problems of the website, really, maybe, freaked a lot of people out. And the numbers were so low, I thought, they're never going to get to 3 million. And so it just has steadily risen, and now it's at 5 million as of March 17th.
Now, I still say your party, or your former party, they're going to rue the day that they voted against all of this. Because as people get it, I truly believe as people get it and take ownership of it, it can only get better, which cannot bode well for the future of the GOP, who not one person voted in favor of it.
For this year, and I know the Democratic side has an extreme amount of paranoia in some camps about this, the whole health care thing. If the White House can react quickly to any speed bumps that occur, I mean, I don't think there's going to be a total breakdown of anything, but any speed bumps that occur, if they can react quickly and decisively on it and correct it, then that will take away a lot of the sting. It's almost like people are waiting for something, to happen. But again, and you said this before too, if the Republicans base everything on Obamacare, it's not going to turn out well for them.
Yeah, I look at this election, and you're a guy who's run a number of campaigns. Do you think it's a smart idea for Democrats to be running on, we'll fix it, instead of saying, look, 5 million people have come to it, we're moving in the right direction, people are taking ownership of it, instead of going, hey, well, we promise, we'll fix it? Because
I had this exact conversation with a very, very talented Democrat strategist from Michigan yesterday, and I compared it to the Gingrich elections where they were morphing us into Newt Gingrich. I've run a lot of elections, of course, as you said, and I never bought into having to defend myself about Gingrich. I kept it to what I stood for, and, if you get into that snare where, you're a Democratic member and you say, we're going to fix it. Well, then how are you going to fix it? When are you going to fix it? Why didn't you fix it already? Yeah. I mean, you can go down this whole path. I mean, I would love for my opponent, if I was running, to do that. I would love for them to take a bite of the bait I put out there.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was Johnson who said if they're explaining, they're losing. I think he said something he wanted to say something that someone was having sex with a cow or something just to hear him say they didn't.
Don't explain it.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of, it is what it is. Anyway, the missing plane, any new developments? I saw one of our tech companies had a bunch of people on the plane. Any new information on where it could be?
No new information, but then there's a ton of theories. You can blow holes in all the theories, but there's one, in my opinion, that's starting to get some traction where, the plane had a type of fire. It turned around. And it had to turn off all the electronic components because maybe it was a fire in the tire. And it had to turn off the components in the cockpit and reprogram. And at that point in time, they could have been overcome with smoke. And it was still on autopilot and went 7 hours on its own on an autopilot into the ocean until it crashed.
Oh, so kind of like the golfer scenario. I forget what the golfer's
name. Right. Payne Stewart.
There you go.
Comparable to the Payne Stewart. And except we track Payne Stewart. Now, the only holes in this, with all of our sophisticated satellites, everybody on Earth has a satellite up there. It's just a wonder nobody could, it's still ping, but maybe, they could have had a visual, but So far, nothing.
It'll be interesting to see if they find it at this point. I hope we get to the bottom of it, because all the conspiracy theories abound. I guess, you know, on some level, it's interesting to hear what comes out of it, but
yes.
Even still. I see today the reports from the Ukraine. A little earlier, we talked with Admiral Sestak, a former congressman, about what's going on in Russia and in the Ukraine. The first, I guess, casualty of what's going on, a Ukrainian officer was killed. They're not quite sure who did it, but still, the prime minister's calling for an international investigation. Anything good going to come out of this?
I don't think so. I believe that, you know, we sat down with Russia today in Vienna, but that's with the basis of the Iranians, you know, and the British and the Chinese. We all sat down today with Iran. Otherwise, we're not, you know, in a very obviously cordial position with Russia. But at the look of this whole thing, Putin got what he wanted. The vote was at 95%, probably not, but was it high? Probably was. And so he got what he wanted, and he's made it official. It goes through their constitutional court, but it'll work for him in Russia. And I'm just, at this point in time, I think it's probably going to be where they just don't want him to advance further, and the European Union will, you know, take up that issue. But reversing it, it's done. Finished. Done. And we could have built up all the military we wanted. We could have built 1,000 more nukes in a day. It would not have done anything, just like when Bush was president in Georgia, to have prevented this.
Yeah. So what you're saying that
some
is...
Some of them you can't win.
Yeah. So what you're saying, in your mind, that Crimea is now part of Russia. That's just a fact of life. But what if they decide they go further, north into other parts of the Ukraine? What then?
I think that would cause a lot of hostility, and the European Union may actually step in with, you know, severe sanctions. And I just don't believe Putin's got his piece of the land now. You know, he's pretending. Nobody is really talking about democracy, really, very much. This is economics, pipelines, oil, gas. Putin wanted not to, you know, the Ukraine was a buffer between Russia and Europe. Now he has his own little buffer there. And that's what he wanted. And it's ironic that his prime minister, his handpicked guy, going out of there, allowed all this to happen. Yanukovych.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it is amazing. Do you find that some of the rhetoric we've heard here in the U.S., do you think it's destructive? Do you think it's not good? I mean, I look at Sarah Palin saying, well, you know, Putin fights grizzly bears and doesn't wear a shirt or underarm deodorant. Obama, he wears mommy jeans or some nonsense like that. Does this talk any good? Because I remember going back to the Cold War. I'm old enough to remember these kind of push-pull scenarios happening occasionally. And I don't remember our politicians really sniping at the president, at the administration, like we've seen this time around.
Yeah, I mean, the mom jeans, who's tougher than whom, you know, who can stick their chest out and beat it more. You know, John McCain, I mean, and of course when he's confronted, he doesn't know what he's talking about or what to say. But, you know, the veiled threat of military action or boots on the ground, I mean, that's just all insanity to even, you know, allude to that. But it's been, you know, just in a way useless chest bumping. The other thing that on the world stage that makes, and me in particular, because I was part of the thing, makes me cringe is when we put our finger out there, and I know Putin's not a good guy, but we, you know, you invaded.
Yes.
Well, yeah, we did too, and we invaded over a lie. So that one, I don't know about you, but I kind of say, ooh, let's not use that argument.
No, I did when Kerry came out and said, you know, we don't, in this century, we don't do that.
I'm going, no.
But John,
yeah.
Buddy. I voted for you.
We did it one year after the turn of the century.
Yeah, yeah. Well, maybe they didn't get the stationery turned over. They didn't get the stationery turned over quick enough.
Maybe
that was it. Well, let me ask you this, because I got a couple of emails from people. The conversation I had yesterday with Zach and Luke from Talk Radio News, there was some comments about the possible intimidation. I had mentioned that, you know, for all I know, they had clear plastic boxes that people had to put their ballots in with soldiers standing next to them. And some people took that as, you know, may have been what happened. I got a couple of people emailing me, said, that none of this intimidation is viable, and all this is, you know, just for the military-industrial complex to build more stuff. Any reports in your world of that kind of intimidation of you know, a little, maybe a little arm twisting, maybe a little heavy-handed pressure? Because, you know, in talking with Zach, who's over there, some of the people are saying, you know, this is a throwback to the Soviet days.
Well, I think the sheer presence of you know, military, I believe the fact that, you know, Putin's KGB, and he mm-hmm. was KGB. He still leans that direction. People, there's veiled threats. I mean, a lot of things could happen. I think it was going to win. I'm not sure it was 95%.
Right. Yeah, and I guess 14% of the people, the one sect, the Tartars or something, they boycotted it, didn't even bother. So it's going to go through. Why do we get involved in it?
Yeah, they do that a lot. Iran does that, too. If they don't like the current ruler, they say, well, we're not going to vote. We'll show you. It's always good to vote, but they do tend to do that overseas. They take a little different theory than here, where you get mad and you vote anyway, you know, if you can.
Yeah, that's if you get mad here. So most of us just turn away and go, ah, they're all crooks. I'm going to stay home and complain.
That's right.
It is the American way, is it not? So some information, some news on Janet Yellen. So far, we like Janet, right? I kind of do. She hasn't done anything horrible yet.
Well, you know, Janet was not the progressive's choice. However, you know, Larry Summers was the original choice that Wall Street was pushing the president to nominate Larry Summers, who's, you know, been around. He was Clinton's guy.
And thank goodness they didn't.
Well, yeah, you know, if you look at Janet Yellen, she's the liberal of the century compared to Larry Summers, to be honest with you. But some of the progressives were, you know, a little bit grumpy about everything. But I think she's turning out to be a lot better than they thought she would be. And I think that Janet Yellen, with these 2 days that she's had her first, you know, open meetings, will probably bring a breath of fresh air, I think, to the process.
So far, what's she doing right now, then, to bring that fresh air?
Yeah, look, they have she's going to assess about the 6.5%. When you go back historically, and that's the unemployment threshold, when you go back historically, you know, they used to say, well, you know, the unemployment, that's just a part of, you know, the unemployment's the last to come.
Right.
So that's not our task. It's our task is about interest rates. And that goes way back to, what's his name? I'm having a
Volcker.
Volcker, and before Volcker. And then Bernanke came in and started to change the game plan. And I believe that what she's saying, you know, is that, she's going to keep with the thought that Bernanke had, you know, which is they do have a task on unemployment.
Well, yeah, aren't the two originally the beginning of the Fed had two tasks? One was to fight inflation,
right.
But the other one was to promote full employment. And I don't know how you can do both simultaneously and have one benefit over the other. We've been focused since Volcker too much on fighting inflation and not so much on full employment, which is where I didn't like Greenspan, but I gave Greenspan credit for allowing the interest rates to stay lower and allowing unemployment to fall lower, because there's always been this belief 5% unemployment was full employment. And he let it fall down to about 3.5-4% before they started doing anything.
Right now, that threshold is 6.5.
Yeah, which is ridiculous.
Yes, percent threshold. But I time will tell on Janet Yellen. But I believe that she, you know, she's talking about transparency, of course, and time will tell. But I think she will have some opportunities to do some things.
And finally, Larry Summers, who, thank goodness, is not the Fed chairman.
Oh.
I hear he's out and about.
Well, you know, when you don't make Fed chairman, what do? Well, you have to keep your name alive. It's an ego thing. And what he has done, and I don't know how much traction it's going to get, Rick. You'll know better than I. But, you know, the Democratic side's coming off of a loss in Florida. They lost that seat, okay? So everybody, you know, in D.C. is saying, oh, that's it. They're doomed. They're doomed. So there's a little bit of a semi-panic, I guess, and among some people. So Larry Summers is out there being quoted, and he's part of this pro-business wing, is what they're calling it, of the Democratic Party, and they are ready, quote, to draw up new plans for this election.
Really? Is there anything other than the pro-business wing? Because all I keep seeing our president do, best thing Wall Street ever came up with was Obama, because I don't see him reinstating Glass-Steagall. And I thought that we already had a pro-business wing. I thought that was the Clinton wing, the DLC wing.
Well, they had that DLC, they called it. And then Larry Summers' quote is this: reducing inequality is good, but it's 50 times better to do it by lifting those up who are low than by tearing those down who are high.
Ah.
And that's his quote. So, you know, I really would find it amazing if the average mainstream Democratic politico is going to follow Larry Summers around the country this summer, you know, with these statements. If they do, then there is an absolute complete panic attack.
No. I mean, you look at all of the third way, the Demos, the fix the debt Democrats, the DLC, and now we got the Larry Summers types. I mean, it doesn't surprise me. Much like the Republicans have the Tea Party Republicans, well, we've got the corporatists. It is what it is.
You have the Republicans in complete disarray, but you're starting to see. I've seen it a lot. I talked to my friends on Capitol Hill, but in the last 3 weeks, you're starting to see this panic attack on the Democratic side. So,
well, like they say, gonna snatch victory or defeat out of the jaws of victory.
That's right.
Sad stuff. Bob, it's always great talking with you, man. I appreciate you taking time for us.
Thank you.
Bob Ney, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Radio of, for, and by We The Working People. The Rick Smith Show.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Albert Klein. The Obama administration has begun working with the Commerce Department on transitioning the third-party oversight of the Internet, a plan that has been in place since 1998. However, Fox News hosts use this opportunity to falsely claim that President Obama is giving away the Internet. On Fox's America's News headquarters, host Greg Jarrett said,
in the 1960s, this thing was developed with American money by the Department of Defense. Taxpayers paid for this whole thing. So why should the Obama administration or one president make a decision to give away something that has been probably one of the greatest world inventions ever by Americans?
As the New York Times explained, the U.S. has been subcontracting the assignment of Internet addresses to the Internet Corporation for assigned names and numbers since 1998. ICANN was created as an international nonprofit organization with the expectation that the U.S. would eventually step back from its role. For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
Tales of American Political History with Clinton Porter Hackney.
We've been talking about the President's Office of the Press Secretary and who the first one might have been. When we last talked, I challenged you to pick from one of six men who I can argue was our first real press secretary. First of all, presidents in the early days had few to none when it came to assistance. There wasn't much money, there wasn't much media, and there weren't really all that many American citizens. The first president appropriated money for a staff was Ulysses Grant, who had all of six staffers. Even as late as Calvin Coolidge in the 1920s, the president had less than 50 people on staff at a cost of less than $100,000. But along the trail of American presidents, it was always important to engage the news media. So join us again for the early candidates for the first presidential press secretary. This is Clinton Porter Hackney at cphackney.com.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
When you can't stop the sounds of the truth. Lock your feet, check out the Rick. What can't Rick but me? You can't kill the process. Can't kill. You can't kill the process.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therichsmithshow.com. So a little bit of insanity to finish up tonight with. You know, and I always love Pat Robertson. You know, you got to give him credit. You know, he's still at this age, you know, getting the, doing the outrage, doing the shock jock thing. And, you know, Chris, think of that, the Christian shock jock. that's our boy, Pat. And how much crazier can you get? Evidently, a viewer named Barb had explained to Pat the shock jock in a letter that her father abused her mother for years. He was just, you know, your basic SOB, man. Just somebody you didn't probably want to be around. And she tells this story about how you know, he got sick, and, you know, on the advice of her pastor, she went, you know, to forgive him and, you know, went to him to apologize for anything that she had done wrong. And I go, wait a second. Typical enabler mentality. The person who's abused me, I'm going to apologize to, because I may have done something wrong for you to yell at me, and I may have done something wrong for you to beat my mother. But, you know, Pat stays right along in that vein. Evidently, she had cancer twice since this attempt to apologize to her father, and he basically booted her to the curb. And, you know, she vowed to, you know, to never talk to him again. She hadn't gone back. She disowned him, she said in the letter. And she said, well, since, you know, I've had cancer twice and, you know, I've not been contacted by him, you know, what do I do to deal with this heartache? And he says, well, you know, that could be the cause of your cancer. You know, basic cause and effect. You didn't talk to your father all those years. So maybe it's your fault that this all went on. It's really very, very odd to me. But what you end up getting is you end up with people who say, well, you know, maybe it is my fault. Sad, sad stuff. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally. Thanks for being here. Have a great night. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick@thericksmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the lunar sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous rain.